1379. This is one I like particularly. For punishment of devisers of false news and reporters of horrible and false lies concerning prelates, dukes, earls and barons and other nobles and great men of the realm, whereof great peril and mischief might come to all the realm and quick subversion and destruction of the said realm if due remedy be not provided.
This is Bristol. It's Friday. It's just after 5 o'clock. World War III, week 16. Don't think this is all going away because of this little deal, folks. Well, it's actually quite a big deal. Welcome to the Bristol Politics Show on the 19th of June 2026, streaming live from the Cumber Centre, close by the Merchant Venture Illuminati headquarters, Bristol City Centre. So don't believe a word we say, but we do try to share moments of clarity here from Bristol's Templar Port turned merchant venturer's fiefdom in the City of London's Empire of Lies. Bristol's only national news show is coming to you live on the talkradio.org.uk stream, djplugradio.co.uk in Nuneaton, Warwickshire, holylandradio.com, 87.7 FM in West Sweden, Wisconsin, 11 a.m. Central Time, that is. And live on the Politics Show app. That's the Bristol Politics Show app, available free from GitHub. Easiest place to find it is via the thisweek.org.uk link, and also from the Apple App Store at thisweek.org.uk is the page, but not on the evil Google Play. This show is repeated at 11 p.m. on Fridays and at 11:05 a.m. and p.m. all week on the Talk Radio stream, except 5 p.m. Monday to Thursday, when we bring you the Richie Allen Show live. So I talk about this being Bristol's only national news show, but of course there is another national news show from London, one of the best, which is being axed by the man from Google. The new director general at the BBC is getting rid of the World Tonight and also the Midnight News Bulletin, so I suppose they're just going to switch over to World Service, which is increasingly going down the tubes, just like so much of the BBC. This is a great delight, of course, for the Murdochs of this world, who are private news people, who, and the Comcasts, who are just an American company just taking over ITV right now, are just rubbing their hands saying, well, we can buy the news now. So well done, Google man, in the top of the BBC, and well done, actually, the NUJ for standing up against this. Increasingly, of course, this is going to mean that you're only going to be able to get any kind of decent news service outside of the mainstream. And if people who ever listen to The World Tonight at 10 o'clock every weekday evening, it is actually a really good program. There's been a couple of articles, I think, a little bit limp, actually, this week in The Telegraph and The Eye Paper, one from Robin Lustig, I think. I'm not sure if Tim Llewellyn, who was also a presenter of The World Tonight, has also put something in there. But anyway, this is a terrible, terrible thing that this Google guy has done, the CIA guy, now in charge of the BBC, and it's saving nothing. It's saving pennies. But what it's doing is it's dumbing us all down. So that's what Google do, folks. And in fact, as we were hearing the last few weeks, that's exactly what they do with their Android platform, just like Microsoft did before them. I suppose that Google had to do that so that people would think that there was some difference between Google and Microsoft, which of course there isn't. There were legal differences about 7 or 8 years ago, but they just settled their differences and said, well, we won't sue you if you don't sue us, so let's just screw the public, Microsoft and Android. So tonight, 7 o'clock, we're hoping to hear live from John Harris, the author of several books on Rudolf Hess and his enigmatic flight to Scotland, to the RAF Dundonald, back in 1941, just before Operation Barbarossa, when the Nazis invaded Russia. He was trying to make some sort of peace deal, but he was being, actually, I think, many of us think, spun out of the way, because it led to the rise in power of a certain British agent, some would say, agent of international fascism, called Martin Bormann, into a much more powerful position controlling Adolf Hitler back in 1941. Also, we'll be hearing quite a lot from a lovely guy, Roger Cook, a Kiwi reporter who was doing his stuff in the heyday of broadcasting and was kicked out in the 1990s mainly. He made his way from Checkpoint on BBC Radio 4 to the television station, television with the Cook Report. And it really enhanced the programme no end, of course, being on television, because Roger would face the crooks down. We'll be hearing various extracts from that tonight, and also a bit of the interview that I did with Roger personally at his home in just near Bradford-on-Avon a few years ago. So very sad to say Roger's no longer with us, but of course his inspiration and his recordings go on, and I'm really, really pleased to see that. I don't know if you remember this, Martin, when we broadcast on BCFM that interview with Roger Cook, at the end of it you and I both said anyone has got recordings, because he told us, the last thing he told us was that the recordings had all been burnt in a fire at Carlton Television's video store, and that they didn't have any left, and there were none left. And so what's been happening since then, over the last decade or so, is loads of people have found old videotapes with the Cook Report on and uploaded them, and there's a whole collection of them now on YouTube, almost every single one.
Well, that's very good that he was able to rescue that archive.
Well, no, David Cameron was in charge at Carlton TV at the time that all burnt down, so maybe that was one of the little jobs he did which gave him his sort of leg up into politics. Who knows? We'll also obviously be hearing a bit from Andy Burnham. In fact, we'll be starting with him in a minute, the new Prime Minister, supposedly, the guy that the two right-wing parties neither of them stood aside to make sure he got in, but actually it looks as if there was such a strong protest vote against Starmer that even if it had been just Labour and either Reform or Restore Britain, that Andy Burnham would still have won. Anyway, also we'll be looking at the peace deal with Iran and Trump. We never know. Every time we start this show, you never know if the war is going to escalate or calm down. It certainly seems to have calmed down. The fuel prices, I think we can see, Martin, your down payment, you might even get that back on your electric car now. You could see your fuel prices are all coming down, but things are getting far worse with the Ukraine conflict. So it's almost as if it's one or the other. The eye of Sauron has been swiveling from Gaza and Iran over towards Russia. So anyway, I'm Tony Gosling. Thank you for turning off the psycho in the corner, gaslighting us with its accelerationist zero trust agenda, bending our minds with Orwellian BBC Verify, and boring us to tears with vacuous celebrities, puff pieces on the conspirators, and hatchet jobs on the heroes. The Daily Mail is getting particularly bad at this now. If you see a hatchet job in the Daily Mail, it stands out a mile. You look, oh, well, that person's probably good, the person they're having a go at there. It's almost as if Tony Blair is writing these articles, because everyone would know it was the opposite of the truth. For those with eyes to see and ears to hear, the so-called solutions to the multiplying crises, housing, unemployment, Gaza, Ukraine, healthcare, competence, obesity, migrants, prisons, farming, cost of living, climate, these accelerationist Armageddonist solutions are crafted to make every crisis worse. Nick Land's social Darwinists, running Albert Pike's Zionist Armageddon plan, want us as slaves to AI or dead. Meanwhile, the wife-murdering pantheist Wef King Tampon Charlie and his vampire queen Carmilla wage war on the British public, as well as Iran, China, Russia, the BRICS, anyone who's not in their death cult. The Crown prosecutes us for praying for unborn children, or did, and the only right they wanted us to have is the right to kill ourselves. Hitler was the prototype. Now Chaos Lord Netanyahu is trying to roll out a red carpet for the Zionist man-god messiah to come. But it's not the end of the world. Or is it? So helping us navigate the WEF's Fourth Reich in Bristol, Britain, around the world, is Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. What do you make of the Makerfield result? Any surprises? Not really. I mean, on this show several times we predicted he was going to win, didn't we?
Well, I think the surprise for me is that it was such a convincing victory. I expected he was going to win. But he got more than 50% of the votes cast. So if it was a proportional election, he would have won anyway.
There is a rule now, it seems, in democracy, in all democracies, is that people are not voting for anybody actually in an election. They're voting to keep somebody out or to try and get rid of someone.
Well, first past the post, that's what it does. It forces you to vote against what you don't want.
Martin, that's just not true. It's the quality of the candidates and it's the quality of the leadership.
No, it's also the electoral system, Tony. In Ireland, it doesn't work like that.
Yes, it does, actually.
It doesn't work like that in Ireland.
Yes, it does.
It just doesn't. No, you have coalitions in Ireland.
And always coalitions. Well, there's always coalitions in the Netherlands, too.
But that's right.
The thing is, what you're doing is you're voting, hoping for a coalition which is going to keep out the people you don't want. The leadership quality, surely you'd agree that there is no leadership quality.
We've had this discussion many's the time.
If you're going to choose between Kemi Badenoch or Ed Davey or Andy Burnham, you haven't got much of a choice, really. The only choice, it seems to me, is somebody like Zach Polanski who might make a real difference.
Yeah, but Zach Polanski hasn't got enough support to win on his own.
Couldn't he have a coalition anyway with Labour, for example?
This is what Andy Burnham needs to do. He needs to talk to the Greens, and they need to form a coalition before the election. What he really needs to do is, when he becomes Prime Minister, and I think he is going to be Prime Minister, the first thing he's going to do, we're going to bring a little bill before the House of Commons to bring in proportional elections in this country. I would go for the Irish-style system of multi-member constituencies.
That's just a pipe dream.
No, it's not. It's not, Tony. We've got a world war and a banking collapse.
It's not going to happen, Martin. I know you're shouting, but it's not going to happen. Right, makes you think it is going to happen?
Well, Andy Burnham got the votes of Green voters in Makerfield because he said he was going to bring in PR. The same with Liberal Democrats. They lost their deposits. Both of them and the Conservative lost their deposit. That's because Burnham is appealing beyond the Labour tribe and saying we need to change the political system.
So will he be able to?
He should just pick up the ball and run with it.
Will he be able to?
No. The problem is, Tony, that he could do that, but he probably won't, because he's going to be advised by lots of nitwits from the Blairite wing of the party.
He's not really a leader. He's a follower of the nitwits.
Well, no, the thing is, it depends. The thing about politics is sometimes you end up in power and you have to do things more radical than you imagine, because the situation is dire. We're about to have a banking collapse and everybody's going to be put out of work.
Martin, you've been saying that for like 15 years.
All right, well, when it happens, Tony, you will understand.
Yeah, I'm sure, yeah.
Yeah. And then, of course, you can't just piddle around saying we're going to nationalise this bit of this and the other. Yeah? You've got to actually go for something much more serious.
But he can't. He's not in charge, really. Anyway, let's have a listen to what Andy Burnham has got to say. I know you make your silly little noise
I'm
not trying to agree with you, Martin. I'm trying to tease out a little bit of actual truth. The advisers, what you're saying is he's promised this, and now his advisers are going to tell him you can't do it. Who's actually in charge? That's the question. Let's have a listen to Andy Burnham's speech this is just a little extract from it earlier today, when he's setting out what he's going to do, or he plans to do, before his advisers twist his arm.
I did talk about the need to change Labour in this campaign, and we've got to now take this moment to answer the challenges that have been laid down. I did describe it last night as a last chance to change, and I think that's how people here kind of saw it when I was talking to them on the doorsteps, and they said, well, Andy, maybe we can give you our support this time, but you know it's not a blank cheque. It's not ongoing. You have to respond to what people here are saying. You have to do something to make life more affordable, to put more money in people's pockets, to give people more breathing space again so that they can have a better life. That's what people were saying, and we must respond to that. We need an economy that works for everybody, not a few in far off places from here, but economy that works for people right here. We do need to bring down water bills, energy bills, rail fares, just as we've brought down bus fares in Greater Manchester, to make life more affordable for people. We do need an end to trickle-down economics, which didn't trickle down very much at all to places like this. We want to see a new drive of reindustrialisation across the north of England and indeed the rest of the country. And big change in Whitehall, if that is to happen. And I'm talking about public procurement. It's about time we started backing British business and British industry so that we can reindustrialise places like this. And yes, let's change the education system so that young people growing up here have clear paths into that new industry. No more an education system dominated by the university route, but an education system that offers a path for everybody, academic and technical, in equal balance. That's what we need if we are to change this. And when I say change to public procurement, as a result of using the power of it, get more work placements for people, a guarantee of a work placement for every 16 to 18 year old who wants one, the guarantee of an apprenticeship. These are the kind of changes that we need if we are to give hope to young people growing up in this part of the world. And yet, a change too from the Home Office. I heard on so many doorsteps people's concerns about the unfairness of the immigration system, that cut price approach to procurement that means areas like this can end up like HMO Britain. It's not fair that they think that they can just operate like that and not hear the call of people here, the decent people here, who always will do the right thing, the compassionate thing, but not when it's unfair in terms of the way places like this are treated. These are the calls that we've got to hear, and this is the change that we've got to bring. And I say it again, it is our last chance to change, but we're going to take it, aren't we? We are going to take that opportunity, and we are going to lay out a new path for Britain.
Well, that's just an extract from Burnham's speech around about 11 this morning, something like that, after his victory, quite a good victory too. But he's talking there about water, energy, buses. He's not actually saying we're going to renationalise them, railways, etc., is he?
No, I mean, that speech is long gone, sort of, motherhood and apple pie, if you like, but the question of how do you do all of that, well, that's a bit more nitty-gritty, isn't it?
He's not talking about renationalising anything, which is obviously the thing that needs to happen. In fact, there is I think right now there's a bid to renationalise Thames Water. He's not even mentioning that. So does he know about it? Who knows? But he's addressing this idea of the cost of living, but he's not really explaining how he's going to do it. This is an aspiration, not a plan.
I think that's right. What he's doing there is he's just pressing all the right buttons, what people want to hear, but he's not being given specifics, because in actual fact, if he comes to be Prime Minister, it's going to be possibly in the middle of the worst economic crisis since the 1930s, and he won't be able to, there'll be all sorts of emergency measures that he may or may not have to take, so we'll just have to see.
Well, he's talking also about things like apprenticeships and work placements for young people, but he didn't mention jobs or work for them.
Well, the problem is the macroeconomic situation in Britain and around the world is dire, and the likelihood is that things are going to get worse before they get better.
So who is the Prime Minister if he can't do things like this? Surely this, what he seems to be, and you seem to be implying, and I would certainly imply, is it's actually the city and big business that is need to move if we could increase the number of jobs for young people, and the government are just twiddling their thumbs.
Yeah, but what will happen if the city is thrown against the wall by an economic crisis? Suddenly they're going to be in the firing line, and you can actually take measures against them,
You keep saying this, but I think the city are actually in the driving seat.
Well,
and
they are.
Slowly but surely.
That's right. That's why there's going to be a crash.
No, because they're slowly but surely acquiring more and more assets and wealth. Why on earth should they crash? They're not likely to do that at all.
I think Musk's whole SpaceX thing is going to crash.
Musk. When
that crashes, it pulls everything else down as well.
No, it doesn't. Everything.
All right.
I mean, all I'm saying,
maybe,
Martin, is when this balance between the city and Westminster is there? I mean, it just seems to me the city is totally in charge.
Well, they have
they
been
just
for
say,
years.
Oh, you can't do that. You can't do
yeah,
that.
Yeah, they have been for years. They've been in charge since Margaret.
Well, we had a Goldman Sachs Prime Minister under Rishi Sunak, didn't
that's
we?
That's right. So, in other words, in normal times, they normally control things. But if the whole world economy gets thrown against the wall, suddenly people are going to ask questions. Why? Because, of course, once the banking system goes bust, you don't have to pay to nationalise it. It's already bankrupt.
I think
you just take it over.
I think this is a pipe dream. The banks are
not
in charge.
What should have happened in 2008.
The banks are in charge, and actually they are, at the moment, they are just doing what they want.
Yes.
And they're acquiring more assets, more wealth all the time.
That's right.
From ordinary individuals.
That's right.
And so the idea that they're going to go bankrupt or bust, I mean, it may be that if this...
They went bankrupt already in 2008,
again,
remember?
All right, yeah. Look, Martin, Can you stop interrupting? I'm just trying to make a point, and you just interrupt going back to 2008. That's 15 years ago, okay? And it happened. But it doesn't have to happen again. And, of course, it was a fleecing of the public, that whole business. But it doesn't affect where we are now, which is the banking system is very, very powerful. The financial institutions are incredibly powerful, and they're not going to be stumbling over unless, for example, the Straits of Hormuz are closed for a long, protracted period. This might cause them all sorts of trouble. It might even cause a stock market crash. But you can still see that these people are still holding assets. They're holding definite assets, whereas ordinary people are struggling to get the income to keep their families.
Well, you're right. They have far too much power. And under normal circumstances, when New Labour came to power in the late 90s, the economy was actually growing and they could actually spend more money on things like the health service without massively raising taxes on the wealthy. But, of course, we're not in that position now. And ultimately, of course, this, when Gordon Brown was the Prime Minister in 2008, what he could have done is nationalise the banks and kept them nationalised.
Martin, there's no point in going back 15 years. You keep making this point.
All right, but
he should have done it
again?
And he didn't.
If Burnham
the same
Burnham's
sort of thing is probably going to happen unless they haven't got the money to bail them
out. That's right, because they haven't got the money. They can't, and Britain can't just print money unlike the United States.
Well, there is no subprime mortgage crisis right now, as we know.
But, mortgage crisis, it's going to be a different kind of
As the house prices start to go down, if they do, then there might be.
Yes.
I'm glad you brought up AI, because that's something I'd like to go into in a bit of depth now. Because did you know the government has an AI minister?
Well, it wouldn't surprise me.
Do you know who they are?
No.
Do you know that they're also the AI and online protection minister?
No.
Well, let's have a little listen to them. He popped up on the Evan Davis show. You know, this is so annoying the way the BBC Radio 4 particularly operates, because the Evan Davis programme is he's so obsequious towards all these complete and utter idiot wonks we're just about to hear from about AI. And so that programme is staying, but the good programme, The World Tonight, is going. This is how the BBC functions. So let's have a listen to this minister, Anushka. It sounds like a lady's name, but anyway, it's not. It's a bloke, and he's in charge of AI, would you believe, appointed by her tampon Charlie as a minister.
I, a little earlier, spoke to the Minister for AI and Online Safety. He is Kanishka Narayan, and I asked him whether there was still time for technology companies to stop a ban here by introducing changes that would protect young people.
No, Evan, I think they've had too many second chances. We have heard very, very clearly that for young people under the age of 16, the extent of harm is so deep that we need a break glass moment. This is that moment. We are banning social media for young people under 16. That said, for 16 and 17-year-olds, there are harmful features that we want to turn off by default. So not banning, but turn off by default, where we think if platforms continue to improve, there's a path there to make that experience better. And so there is still an opportunity for those who are older to have a safer experience online, both through our regulatory pressure and hopefully through product design. But for under 16s, the scale of damage is so extensive, the duration of it so significant, that there isn't a second chance now.
Okay, it's done. Have you worked out how you're going to do it? Or is that now a project for the next 12 months? I'm asking because, of course, a lot of people are saying this is much harder to deliver than just simply passing a law.
Well, I don't doubt the difficulty of it. I've been grappling with this for 9 months in this job, and so I feel the weight of that. Today, we're announcing the big picture policy. There are some aspects of implementation we're announcing. So in Australia, the way in which age checks are done is a legal test of reasonable steps. In Britain, we are going to have a tougher test. And so some aspects are clear, but now we have to work with the regulator, with companies, to make sure that the underlying detail, that is worked out as well. And so it's not going to be a year of waiting. We are moving at lightning speed on this. We have been very quick on consulting, very quick on deciding. We will be as quick as possible on putting it into the books of statute and then implementation.
But out of interest, would it be fair to say that one of the consequences of this, of trying to prevent the under 16s, is that everybody who is 16 or over will have to demonstrate their age in order to do virtually anything? Because for a 40-year-old to be on Instagram, will have to prove that he, she is not 15. And so essentially, it will become a norm for all adults to be proving their age all the time.
Well, I think it's a bit more nuanced than that. So, yes, it's true that to stamp out child abuse for under-16s, we need platforms to figure out whether someone is under or over 16. But in terms of ways of doing that, if you've had, for example, an account for more than 15 years, it's pretty obvious that you're going to be over 16. And so in those cases, it's unlikely the platform is going to ask you to do anything further than what you have. If you have a credit card associated with an account already, or if you have, for example, email addresses associated with accounts, which you can do behavioral inference on and tell that someone is clearly over 16, you don't need to do much more than that at all. And so, yes, in some cases, we might, in extremis, have to make sure that we do a once sort of age check at the very outset, but this is not going to be some sort of deeply painful recurring experience of giving data over, quite the opposite.
Yeah.
Well, he's agreeing with him there. He says, this is at the end. No awkward questions like, what if people sell their accounts? Older people sell their accounts to younger people and give them their passwords and all this sort of thing. So it's obviously going to be easy to get around this. It seems to me that this, that what they've been doing with the internet over the years is making us more and more and more dependent on it. And now they're saying, right, if you want to use the internet, we need to know exactly who you are. We want all your credentials, whatever it is, driving license, passport, digital ID.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's a very awkward situation because it's very hard to enforce anything to do with this. I mean, in Australia, they've already brought in this under-16s ban, but in actual fact, most teenagers are still accessing the internet as they were before because it's virtually impossible to stop them.
Yeah, and it's people like him. His name is not Anushka, it's Kaniska. Ariane, apparently he's the AI and online safety minister, if you can believe that, his attitude seems to be that he's got this kind of haughty, you know, yes, we've sorted it out, we're doing everything, but I'm not so sure that this is going to be in any way an easy thing to do. So the internet has been a sort of sewer, really, and it's also got some brilliant stuff on it as well. So everyone is kind of drawn to it, whether they're a weirdo or whether they're, you know, someone that wants to find out what's really going on in the world, and particularly because the mainstream media, the London-based mass media, news media particularly, has been so appalling. You know, in order to find out what's going on, you have to go on the internet.
Well, that's right. I mean, I think it's very, you know, it's like a lot of things. You can say this is what you want to do in the real world. It's like saying we're going to make drugs illegal. They are illegal, but people still do them, and there's a huge industry involved, and it's not going to go away anytime soon.
Can I ask you specifically about YouTube? Because YouTube is a lot of different things. Indeed, for half the world, it's like half the internet. And it is a social media platform, and lots of platforms have made themselves social media, put on short videos and comments so you can interact and almost chat. But obviously, YouTube is also the world's biggest video library, and it's a place where you can get a lot of education, you can get top-up teaching in any subject you want. Can you talk me through the YouTube strategy for this policy?
Sure. Broadly speaking, we obviously want to make sure that some educational services are available to young people in a fulfilling way. With platforms that are user-to-user services with algorithmic recommendation, which are in scope of a ban, let's say in Australia, young people are still able to go on those platforms, type in the search box, geometry lesson, and access that video. And so what we're not doing is fully stamping out someone watching a video like that on TV sitting next to their parents. What we're doing is stopping the creation of a new account, which then results in the sort of data-driven algorithmic doom-scrolling, going down corridors of recommendations towards unhelpful and dangerous videos that end up being deeply harmful for young people as well. And so we're stopping the most harmful bits, but we're trying as hard as we can to make sure some of the opportunities are captured. Now, there will be platforms where, because it's a nuanced trade-off, that we've come down on the side of protecting young people, and there are some things that are lost in that. I accept that. But the overwhelming sense that we've had is that the scale of harm experienced by young people justifies the decision that we've taken.
Okay. This is really back to the whole issue of the social media ban for the under-16s, is whether you anticipate the big tech companies are going to cooperate.
Well, I'm certainly not relying on the generosity of companies here for enforcement. We're making sure that we're running very fast with the regulator at preparing guidance, at making sure the regulator has the powers, the resourcing it needs, so that straight away out of the gates, we are ready for a context of enforcement if there isn't compliance.
Okay.
Well, I mean, I'll reiterate what I've said before. It's all very well. You can say you're going to do this, that and the other. But the practicalities are that the genie's out of the bottle, the toothpaste's out of the tube, and you can't just put it back in.
But he's saying, yeah, he's being quite tough. He's saying there's going to be compliance or else.
Yes, and of course, the issue is, of course, that adults, as we say, will have to, you know, you'll have to, if, as an adult, you'll have to prove that you're not under 16. But as you say, it's so fungible. Anybody could just sell their account or give their account to somebody else. And, you know, who's to know?
And you can have multiple kids using one account, for example.
That's right. So, in other words, it's very difficult to
and
police
also,
the internet.
Well, we're trying to say what they can, because he's saying there that on YouTube, oh, yeah, they'll be able to watch everything that's educational on there. Well, I mean, how do you distinguish between something that's educational and something that's not? I mean, it seems to me the only way to actually deal with the internet the way it's arrived is that you've got to have cross-country, cross-border enforcement. Or else, you know, you do what China's done and other countries have done, is you just block it. You say, well, if you're not going to arrest people for putting child porn up on the internet, we're not going to allow the internet in this country from your country.
Well, that's right. I mean, obviously, the Chinese have developed their own internet, habitus, as it were, which is different from the one, you know, they control what people can
see.
It's
a bit like globalisation. It's a sort of dumbing down effect, like the lowest common denominator makes the most profits in the globalised economy. And the same with the internet. It's the wherever you can get away with stuff, people go there and then they put it all online, which can be seen around the world. But it doesn't seem to me they've got any attempt here to address that at all.
Well, that's right. It's very difficult to control. You know, there you are.
They're going for the big channels. Like, you know what will happen is you'll get a different YouTube will start to appear, which has got everything on it, which everyone can access. And well, YouTube will start to go down the tube,
won't
it? I
mean, anywhere in the world, I mean, even in Iran, when they took the internet down, people were able, if they wanted to access internet by going through VPNs and so on. But of course,
in fact, they have apps, don't they? You can download an app to just go bypass the national censor, whatever it is.
Yeah. I mean, and it's very difficult for it. One of the real problems is that they're going to, if you've got to have a digital ID, is that the government will then get all that info.
And there's no
and
real.
Then they can use it well, against exactly. you potentially, you know, if it's a Chinese government, the Iranian government, the British government.
There's no actual attempt to really police this. So when there's criminal content, you know, everyone says, oh, it's someone else's job. Oh, I think that server's in America. We can't do anything about it. Never mind. You know, there is no proper attempt, it seems to me, to develop any kind of...
Well, it's difficult to do,
proper
isn't
policy
it? Even
control.
If you want to do it, it's difficult. You know, I mean, no doubt the Chinese censors work really hard to make sure that Chinese people don't get to see the stuff they don't want them to see. But they have to work really hard at it.
Well, before we hear the last clip from this chappie, Kanishka Narayan,
Narayan.
Kanishkanarayan, who is AI minister. Oh, God. I mean, you know, the guy looks like he's AI, actually. This is a photograph of him here. But anyway, he's originally from India. He's just looking at his biography. He joined the Labour Party when he was 18 years old, became a civil servant in the Cabinet Office under David Cameron, and also under Liz Truss, a civil service at the Environment Department. But then he's been in the private sector for a few years after that, and he was in parallel, actually, working as a consultant for a while. Now suddenly he's MP and just like that, minister.
Well, I mean, if you're going to have a minister for AI, and I suggest you probably do need one, then
you're
he's
a civil servant.
Well, no, he was a civil servant. He's got the skills to be a minister, and he's also an elected MP.
Yeah, he's got the gift of the gab. And well, he's mates with the Cabinet Office.
Well, that's how you get to be a minister.
Well, let's see somebody who's going to be an AI minister. I would like to see them from a regulatory point of view, someone with some ethics. So, for example, say the Internet Watch Foundation, somebody who's got a background in a sensible regulation of the Internet, Electronic Frontier Foundation, Big Brother Watch, somebody like that's the sort of person I'd like to see.
Yeah,
and we could trust.
Are those people
you could trust to make some. Well, he's only been made an MP.
No, he's made an MP by an election.
Can do this, isn't he?
You can't be a minister unless you're an MP.
Martin, that's not what I'm saying. It's like he's gone on this little fast track from his consultancy at the Cabinet Office. Then he's been made an MP, and now he's a minister. But he's actually not from the Internet Watch people at all, is he?
No, he's a civil servant.
Yeah, and he's actually very close to the industry itself. He's what he's saying here is he's basically admitting, oh, there's not really, really much, very much we can do, but he's putting a tough face on it.
Well, he's saying we are going to do it, and both you and I are saying he probably can't. But on the other hand, he's making all the right noises from his point of view.
Yeah, so he's living in cloud cuckoo land. Anyway,
well,
so
we all are.
No, we're not. Certainly the people I mentioned, the internet regulation campaigners, are definitely not the Big Brother watchers of this world.
Okay.
So, yeah, well, they're pointing out the flaws in people like him. So let's have a listen to the last clip from this guy, from the Evan Davis, terrible Evan. Well, I mean, it's just all annoying, but it's staying, whereas the world tonight is going, so we just have to get used to Evan Davis.
Just on a completely different matter, but not a completely different matter, if I may, Kanishka, I just wanted to ask you about what the government's feeling is about the US essentially forbidding Anthropic, one of the big AI giants, essentially banning Anthropic, letting any foreigner get hold of its Fable 5 model. This is a very advanced level model. And I just wondered, so the US government has banned Claude Fable 5 from being available to UK users, and whether you have a view of that.
Yeah, I think it's one of the most consequential questions that our politics should be asking. So in the short term, the operational context is that Mythos and Fable, the latest generation of models, have been banned for all users, not just British users. The company has decided to ban it for all users. And so in the short term, we think the impact differentially on us is limited. But the long-term implication is very clear. The single most important question in terms of cybersecurity, our security agencies' ability to be able to engage with drone and counter-drone defense systems, so many of those critical questions rely on our access to frontier AI models. And if you want that access, you have to have some leverage, some chips on the table. And so to me, AI sovereignty is now the central question for our national security and domestic security. We have to take it deeply seriously.
Okay. You don't have an idea how we do that. Obviously, we are big players, and DeepMind, which is a London-based company, is a very big part of Alphabet Google's AI proposition, and a lot of that has come out of London, but it's obviously not detached from the United States.
That's right. So the way I think about how you build leverage is you've got to focus on your strengths. You can't do all of it, especially a country of our size can't do all of it. And so what we have been focused on in our sovereignty strategy is to focus on some particular layers in the stack. So one, we think we have great strengths in chip design with companies like Arm, as well as a series of startups. We've put $1.1 billion into supporting them and building that leverage. Two, outside of language. Language is one form of intelligence, but there are many other forms of intelligence, as you'll know very well. Vision, the ability to discover new scientific models, mathematical models. In those areas, we're backing a series of companies, both directly and indirectly in Britain. And thirdly, we think there are some critical applications in areas like cybersecurity, life sciences, professional services, where Britain has amazing strengths. And so right across those parts of the stack, we need to move further and faster in building leverage and strengths here in the country so that we can sit at the table with our allies as well as beyond that and say, we've got some chips on the table, let's make sure we have critical access to yours.
Kanishka Narayan there, who is the Minister for AI and for Online Safety. A little later in the programme, we'll get the reaction of four 14 and 15-year-olds.
Yeah, a few 14 and 15-year-olds, not Big Brother Watch, Electronic Frontier Foundation, or anybody serious, a bunch of kids. Well, we'll see what their reaction is to this.
Well, as I say, in Australia, they've brought all this in, and it hasn't made, you know, basically kids, you know, kids are quite techie, and they can easily, better than their parents, they know what's going on. The parents don't even understand what they're doing.
Well, he's talking there about this Anthropic AI model ban. This is nothing to do with Britain. This is the United States that's banned it. Donald Trump's administration's cut off access to advanced AI prompts, and he's calling for greater self-reliance. So Artificial intelligence has become the latest issue to drive a wedge, says Al Jazeera, between the US and its allies after US President Trump ordered the tech giant Anthropic to cut off access to its powerful Mythos 5 and Claude Fable 5 AI models, saying national security was the concern. The US issued an order for all foreign nationals in and outside the US promoting Anthropic to take the two AI models completely offline to ensure compliance. I wonder why this really is. Could it have a military application?
Yes, this is what this is about. It's preparing or fighting the already existing World War III. Controlling AI is central to the way that the military think, or the Western military in particular, think about how they're going to win wars in the future. But of course, ultimately, the free market goes out of the window when war comes over the horizon. You've got to control things. It's not a question. I mean, in theory, we should just have a free market and everybody's just, get the AI that they like and at the right price and all the rest of it. But in actual fact, all these things are war fighting material, and therefore, the decisions aren't made on any kind of, economic grounds. They're made on political grounds.
Sam Altman is an OpenAI guy. He's not, is he? Sam, the tech executive, we better serve. This is an article by The Guardian this week. Lusa Guadagnino's, if that's the right pronunciation, Sam Altman movie has been dropped by Amazon because it is partnering with OpenAI instead. The web giant announced that a biopic about the controversial tech executive will be better served if it is released by a different studio. This is a film called Artificial, right, which is obviously going to be so gripping. That's such a great title. It's a controversial Sam Altman biopic poised for an awards run next year, has been dropped from distribution. In a statement, Amazon said it believes the Artificial will be better served if it's released by a different studio. The decision to leave the project comes in the wake of a significant partnership between Amazon and OpenAI, which Altman is chief executive. Oh, okay, so it is. So they're saying that this is going to look bad if we, because they're obviously friends with this guy, Sam Altman, anyway. These people have made an absolute fortune on all of this, and it's also interesting, isn't it, the way they call their things, what was it called? Mythos. This is an interesting word, isn't it? Fable. This is all about creating your own reality.
Well, it is, and of course, it's been hyped to the skies, And of course, with SpaceX, there's the big AI component in that, and that's losing massive money. I mean, all the stuff I'm reading on naked capitalism is that they're soaking up investors, and they're trying to drag in retail investors into it, not just big hedge funds, and they've got no revenue, they've got hardly any revenue and absolutely zero profit.
It's all a wing and a prayer. It's a bit like actually Twitter originally was, isn't it? They never had that.
It's the dot-com bubble on steroids. Yeah. And anyway, of course, in actual fact, that all of this stuff about once we got the internet, it'll be improved productivity, blah 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 blah. The Nasdaq went up through the roof, and then it just crashed.
Because
a lot of this stuff is actually just made up stuff.
These people are accelerationists. I think everyone needs to understand that's what they are. This is the way they think. Is they actually love the idea of helping create crises? I mean, isn't the basic idea of AI? Obviously, it's not in actual intelligence. I've been chatting to people at the NUJ for years and years about this. I mean, probably 20 years ago, 15 at least years ago, talking to some people there, saying, well, of course, it's not actually intelligence at all. It can't think at all. All it can do is repeat, basically. So what's the point of AI? What do you think this is really all about? $1 trillion a year of investment is going into this.
Well, I mean, it's the same things. I mean, part of it is just like this is the South Sea bubble or the tulips.
But it's useful, isn't it? It makes people lazy. Well, if you can prepare, say you're a lecturer at a university, you can prepare a lesson or a quiz, a test for your students. You can ask AI to do it. It takes 5 seconds. If you do it yourself, it might take you 2 or 3 days.
All right, so it's useful for defined tasks. But you could say, it should say to the AI, should I marry Miranda? And they say, well, I'm a computer. Do you fancy her? You know, you can see that there's no real humanity behind AI.
No, it's not really what I asked, though, is it? I was saying, well, what is the actual impetus behind putting all this investment behind it?
Well, Palantir and Alex Karp and all these other people, they know that there's going to be a bust. So what they're saying is we need US government support so that our AI is better than Chinese AI because we're going to war with China. So they're changing the way they're selling it to people. It's not just a brilliant way to find out things and it's you can have AI in your home. They're basically arguing that even though it doesn't make any money, the US government has got to chuck money at it, otherwise the Chinese will beat us and then they'll win World War III. That is not really an economic argument. That's a political
argument. But is there
any
truth to that, though?
Well, I think there is.
And this is something we just AI, heard from the AI States. Is clearly, we've just heard with this banning in the States that they're thinking this AI is. The Chinese can use it against us.
Yes, we don't want to share it. That's right, because it's a military technology. Well, I mean, AI clearly has military uses. It's revolutionising warfare. But on the other hand, it's not the magic bullet for winning wars. I mean, look at the way the Russians have been using AI. They've been creating drones with an AI component. So they send the drone off to go and, you know, shoot tanks or whatever it's supposed to do. But they don't have a computer telling them what the strategy is. I mean, it's pointless. You know, you don't want a computer. All the computer is doing with AI is it's going through all the stuff that's ever been written about on the internet and summarizing it for you. But that doesn't, if it's summarizing stuff that's not correct in the first place, then, you know, it's just wrong. You know, just because it's out there doesn't mean it's right. And of course, they're not really able to distinguish.
You've had your go. I think it's much simpler than that. Is that those in charge finding it more and more difficult to get their little underlings and minions to be cruel and wicked and evil and sociopathic, and so they'd much rather cede their decision-making power, you know, in society in all sorts of ways, and particularly through elite institutions such as media, universities, military, etc., to a computer. Let the computer decide, because my minions won't kill kids. But the computers will.
Well, I mean, obviously, the attack on the school in Tehran, there's two theories. One is that the computer basically made the mistake and they didn't bother to check it. And the other theory, which I tend to agree with, is it was a deliberate attack. Now, you don't need to have AI making mistakes. If you're deliberately going to attack a school with children because that's what you want to do, then you don't need a computer to tell you that, do you?
Anyway, what I'm sort of building up to talking about AI this week is that we've got an absolutely brilliant piece of journalism this week. I'm also itching to tell you because it's from Wired magazine. And this first popped up on my Telegram channel earlier this week. Thanks for whoever popped it up on there. And as I started reading this, I'm thinking, good God, this is incredible. It's so this is about Peter Thiel. A leak has exposed members of Peter Thiel's secretive dialogue society. More than 200 of the world's elites have registered for a retreat whose agenda runs from panels on cult building and sex to prepping for World War III. An associated app offers matchmaking. So this is like a cult, basically. You know, keeping this little group, you can have sex with other members of the group and maybe, you know, sort of form a relationship with them if you're a slightly sad person like Peter Thiel, an unhappy man, a very troubled man, of course, a major Bilderberger and the founder of PayPal, etc. So a trove of internal records from a secret society for powerful figures in US politics, finance and tech was left exposed online. Wired has confirmed names participants in its events and revealing sensitive personal details as they are sure would stay private. The group, called Dialogue, D-I-A-L-O-G, it's private, invitation-only organisation founded in 2006 by the billionaire tech investor Peter Thiel. It convenes US officials, foreign government figures and Silicon Valley executives for off-the-record annual retreats. It's spent two decades declining to disclose its members. But a directory in the website's code was first revealed by the Swiss hacktivist Maya Arson Krimu, that's I think some sort of pseudonym, known for exposing the US government's no-fly list and breaching the surveillance camera company Verdkada. It says, tells Wired the directory surfaced via an anonymous tip. Wired independently verified its contents. So the Wired people also got onto this website, managed to download this database that they thought was secret. A source separately provided Wired with the registration lists for Dialogue's 2026 retreat, which names 222 people, records what the list describes as each registrant's membership status, attendee type, including active member and guest. The retreat's scheduled for the 12th of August to the 16th of August at a venue near Dublin in Ireland. The same data lays out a programme of off-the-record sessions, including money, does, in question mark, buy happiness, bring back nuclear, navigating World War III, battlefield technologies, how's your sex life? Other talks include Build a Cult, Bilderberg, isn't it? Build a Cult, moderated by the founder of the Christian networking site Pray.com. And I wonder if he's a real Christian or a faker. Build a Party, run by former White House national security official. Together, alongside the mundane fare of a typical thought leadership conference, the documents show an extraordinary convergence of power. The registration records list General Alexis Grinovich, NATO's Supreme Allied Commander Europe, and the head of the US European Command, who took the post early last year, and is recorded on the leak list of having attended gatherings since 2021. So this is Peter Thiel, one of the wealthiest men in the world, and also some of the senior people in NATO, all having a little sort of chinwagon bonding, but they're not telling anyone what they're up to at all.
Well, I mean, presumably they wouldn't have wanted this to come into the open. I mean, this is somebody hacked it, isn't it? I mean, they prefer to get... I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? Look at the linkages now between Silicon Valley and NATO. They're taking over. Because this is their lifeline, because in actual fact, all of the AI is a bit of a bubble. But if you can embed it inside the military... The military is a self-licking ice cream cone, yeah. And then, of course, you don't have to worry about selling anything, because you just sell it to the government, and the government just pays for it.
Well, we know about Peter Thiel's, shall we say, obsession with the... I mean, I'm slightly obsessed by the end of the world and this whole idea of the Book of Revelation, but he seems to be more concerned that people are actually learning about it, and so he wants to put out his narrative, his mythos, his fable, to just obscure the truth. That's what it seems to me. Sam Altman, we were talking about a little bit earlier. I mean, he's recently made it very clear what he thinks AI is really all about.
I think AI will probably, like, most likely sort of lead to the end of the world, but in the meantime, there will be great companies created with serious machine learning.
So, at the end of the world, but in the meantime, there'll be great companies created. Great companies like SpaceX, of course.
End of the world, but great companies created.
In the meantime.
I mean, it's just like, wow. I mean, can't people... I mean, if future historians are there, because there might be no future historians given the situation we're in, they will look back on the delusions of these powerful men, and they will shake their heads. Because, I mean, Elon Musk has basically pushed his SpaceX thing on the backgrounds that we're going to build cities on Mars. Yeah, are we?
Well, the interesting thing about all of this is that many of the people who are pushing, they see this as a sort of tribal thing, right? These people have got loads of money. The idea is we think like they do. The money will come to us and we can kind of work for them. This is the way people think. But they've actually got no idea what their real agenda is. There you go. The end of the world, but maybe a few good companies will be created in the meantime. Anyway, so there's another article just out today, actually, on the leak on Wired about this leak. So how the Peter Thiel linked Dialogue Club secretly ranks its members. So in other words, you're a member of the club, but they're actually secretly saying, "Oh, this one is a really useful and important one, and this one we can give more confidential information to, and this one we can't." So the leak files show that the invite-only network grades members by their money and fame, shaping who's in and who's out and who pays. So I imagine that some of them are just invited and they don't have to pay anything. The network, founded by Peter Thiel, co-founded, in fact, grades its event attendees on a hidden scale, ranking them by wealth and fame, tracking their relationships using algorithms to help decide who they should meet, who they should sit with, and who no longer belongs. Oh, you can be banished. Yeah, it's like that Zardoz film. If you step out of line, oh, someone has heard you say something like this, but you won't be told why. You just won't be invited anymore. Oh, I thought you were my friend. I thought you were my friend. The records are part of a trove of internal data received by Wired from a confidential source, containing the personal information on nearly 200 prominent people scheduled to attend the group's annual retreat in Ireland this summer. The data includes home addresses, private home numbers, email accounts, dates of birth, photos, emergency contacts, food allergies, and political leanings. Distinct, though, from a list of people affiliated with Dialogue that was left exposed on the organisation website and circulating online since earlier this week. I haven't heard any of the mainstream press pick up on this, of course. It's massively important when you've got top military people meeting with top Bilderberger bankers. Founded in 2006 by Thiel and data broker Orton Hoffman, Dialogue's a private club. The document, which describes Dialogue as an invite-only community, distinguishes between two products, membership and retreats. The former allows members, the group calls them dialoguers, to access private dinners hosted by members, homes and private spaces around the world, as well as member-led global treks, concierge services and a private group chat and more. Retreats convene groups, if not that private, mate, of 200 or more people who are not necessarily members for 3 or 4 day meetings. This August, for example, speakers and guests are scheduled to gather outside Dublin in Ireland. As I said, 2 days of discussion on artificial intelligence, geopolitics and modern warfare, from NATO's future and battlefield tech to the war in Iran. Hang on, no war right now, folks, and no one's told them, obviously, led by current and former lawmakers, diplomats and national security officials. So this is a sort of secret government, a kind of parallel government we're looking at here. Yeah. They have the power to do make policy, and so this explains in a way why so many of our politicians seem so two-dimensional, because these guys are actually giving them their orders.
Well, that's right. I mean, J.D. Vance is only where he is because Peter Thiel put him there. We know that these oligarchic groups exist, that they're trying to, basically make a power play for total control of the world.
Wired have done a fantastic job with this. Dialogue assigns people in grades. Of the 192 dossiers examined by Wired, 130 are tagged as members. The rest are prospects with files bearing marks first-time dialoguer or warm everyone members and prospective invitees alike is assigned a grade A, B or C. C grade appears reserved for the most famous and influential. Only 1 in 7 has received it. Most people receive a B, and the final tier A appears primarily assigned to older established members who the grade is considered less notable. So in other words, they're not so famous. So this is about influence, isn't it, in society? They want these people for influencing.
Well, what's interesting to me is you've got senior NATO officers attending this. Now, are they doing that in their own time, or are they doing it on the government's time? Yeah, because this is interesting, isn't it? NATO officers supposed to be answerable to the elected government. Now, they're going to this private meeting. Are they going as a private individual, or are they going...
No, they're not going at all. They're not telling anyone that they're even there.
That's right. But, I mean, this is the point about Bilderberg. I mean, the wealthy can have a meeting where they all get together, but the real issue about Bilderberg is the politicians, because the politicians are supposed to be answerable. And so that goes for military officers. You know, you shouldn't really be getting involved in a private sector thing like that if you're a military officer, in my view.
Yeah, but who's going to do anything about it? Well, these useless politicians aren't, are they?
No, because in actual fact, the military are embedded within the private sector. You know, they're privatising a lot of military operations anyway. But what we're dealing with here is an evil oligarchy. And of course, World War III started a long time ago, and lots of people are dying as we speak.
So actor Josh Brolin, who, according to the records, has never attended a dialogue retreat so far, he's categorised as a VIP, largely based on the strength of his fame. His portrayal of Thanos in the Avengers series and his involvement in high-grossing films like Avengers Endgame, which grossed $2.8 billion, contribute to his prominence, reads one note, with Star further citing his Instagram following of over 3.4 million. The Economist Tyler Cowen, this is influencers, isn't it, we're talking about here. Tyler Cowen, by contrast, was initially denied a VIP C rating after the AI tool decided he was widely recognised within his field, but not a leader of an organisation. That is a household name.
Well, I mean, how they make their own decisions about who they're going to promote, all the rest of it, is interesting.
Isn't it? It is very interesting to see that we want the influential people here and we want to tell them what to think.
Yes, I mean, it's all, you know, Palantir and Musk and all the rest of them are determined to embed what they're doing on every level of the military-industrial complex. And as you saw, Sadiq Khan decided not to have Palantir providing the stuff for the Metropolitan Police. And, of course, they're not happy about that. Because the thing is, once the Metropolitan Police have all their stuff done by Palantir, you can't get them out, yeah? They've got it. They're in, and everything. Yeah, and this is the strategy. Once they've got themselves embedded in all of this stuff, and of course the Israeli and US militaries are about to be merged into one organization, and it'll all be glued together by these Silicon Valley companies. It's a nightmare to try and get them out once they're in.
Well.
Which is why, of course, the Chinese don't let them in.
I mean, this is interesting, isn't it? That you've got potentially in a group like this, you've got all sorts of interesting characters. You've got academics, judges, all sorts in there, and politicians. So, anyway, well done, Wired, and I'll put obviously some links to that up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. The expose that they've done, an excellent one too. You mentioned Palantir there. Palantir were really appalling. I mean, they're obviously part of that. Alex Karp, also a Bilderberger with Peter Thiel. He was the founder of Palantir, given the money to do it by Peter Thiel. And this organisation is now very controversial, killing kids in Gaza, killing around the world, actually, by remote control, doing target selection and telling the various drones or aircraft dropping bombs who to kill. And so Palantir, who are they? The Good Law Project were targeted by Palantir. This is another thing they're doing. Seems to me increasingly is going on here. And this is from a woman who was approached by Palantir and from the Good Law Project and they said to her, well, we would like you to put out a load of positive stuff about us and we'll pay you to do it. There's nothing actually illegal about that, I suppose, is there?
Well, not directly, but of course, these things are incredibly suspicious.
Well, you go, have a look at an organisation which is opposed to what you're doing. You then surveil them. You find somebody you think might be vulnerable to being bribed, and you say, "Oh, we think you're a fantastic person. Put out some positive stuff about that. Here's £1,000."
Well, I mean, that's bribery is part of international politics. Both the Iranians and the Russians have been trying to bribe the entourage around Trump. You know, if you do certain things, we will bribe you. Because in actual fact, bribing people is more effective sometimes than trying to crush them.
This is what David Southwell said, the author of The History of Organised Crime and Secrets of Lies, when I interviewed him years ago, is that actually organised crime loves poverty. The more poor the society is, the easier it is to get people to do things. So that's part of it, Burnham. See if you can sort it out, mate. Anyway, let's have a listen now to the Good Law Project people.
Do not mention Palantir. This is about how Palantir tried to pay me to smear Good Law Project. I'm an NHS campaigner and I received an email asking me to get involved in a smear campaign against Good Law Project. I was asked to provide two tweets, a video and a follow-up tweet, and I was asked what my fee would be for providing this service. I was told not to tag Palantir or to mention Palantir in the comments. I felt absolutely horrified to receive this email. I'm not an influencer for hire by private companies, and it was particularly awful because Good Law Project have been doing such important work in this area.
Every attack is a compliment, right? People only pay money to go after you if you're having an impact.
Campaigners are very aware of bad actors operating online. We get trolls and bots coming at us constantly. But the idea that our government is working with a company that operates like this is horrifying. The Shadow Contract. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Well, I mean, you know, it's like watching sausages being made, isn't it? You know, it's the nitty-gritty of how they control things. It's what they used to say in Mexico, silver or lead. Do what we want and we'll pay you off.
And do you know
Don't do what we want, we'll kill you.
Most of the mainstream press, it's these sorts of influencers. They're the only people you ever see. As I was saying on the Evan Davis thing, he wants to talk to about a couple of 15-year-old kids. He doesn't want to talk to any of the people who've been working for the last 30 years, at least, on internet freedom. And so he's not interested in them. What he's interested in is either the people who are driving the latest policy, maybe somebody from one of the AI tech companies, and a bunch of kids that don't know anything about it.
Well, obviously, you can't, you know, this is the deep state, and they don't really want people looking into what they're doing. So that wired leak is very useful. But of course, you know, is anybody really surprised that that's the way the world works? It's always worked like that, really. Let's face it, powerful
well,
people have always
worse.
Been powerful.
Martin, it's getting far worse because the government is saying it can't afford anything apart from shoveling money towards Ukraine. Anyway, last week we led, really, with the tale of this horrific court case with all these peace campaigners, non-violent direct activists, all being jailed as if terrorists. I think the total sentences they got was something like 25 years.
Yeah.
At the time, I didn't have the actual sentence, because this happens nowadays. If you want to go and record something in a courtroom, you can be put in jail for contempt of court. But for some reason, the courts seem to like certain cases to be broadcast, and this is one of them. Here's the judge. I think I just kept calling him. It was an old friend of mine suggested you could call him Judge Jeffries because of his ridiculous sentencing. Actually, Judge Jeffries was at the time of the Monmouth Rising, if I'm right, in Somerset, and he was called the Hanging Judge, who came in to kill or get hanged a lot of the people who'd been involved in the Monmouth Rebellion. Do you want to just say something a little bit about that? Judge Jeffries is an interesting character. I mean, particularly nasty chap. That was the period after the English Civil War, after the Restoration, where there were attempts to bring in new monarchs over to govern Britain. Eventually, it was successful in the Glorious Revolution with King Billy.
Well, that's right. I mean, it was Monmouth was an illegitimate...
Duke of Monmouth.
Yeah, he's an illegitimate son of Charles I, Charles II, wasn't he? And, of course, it was essentially, it was a Protestant uprising because they didn't want to have King James, because James was basically a Catholic. And, of course, they didn't manage to succeed. But ultimately, as you say, the Dutch army came over at the invitation of Parliament, and King Billy became king, and with all of the consequences that followed.
Yeah, like the Bank of England, all sorts of things.
Yeah. England, you know, and the conquest of Ireland and all the rest of it, Battle of the Boyne and all the rest of it.
So that was really the ceiling, I think, of the Civil War. So the Restoration was a bit of everyone thought, oh, it's okay, you know, that we're going to have plays criticising the crown again, we can have a bit more of an easy time of it after the English Civil War, but no, not allowed. Anyway, sorry, that was just a total distraction from what's really going on here, which is, it's Shane Collins, actually, the old friend of mine, talked about him as Judge Jeffries. But let's have a listen to him handing down his sentence last Friday on these amazing heroes.
Would you each stand up, please? Charlotte Head, for the offence of criminal damage, I sentence you to a special custodial sentence of 6 years less 45 days. That consists of a custodial term of 4 years and 320 days and a 1 year additional licence. I disqualify you from driving for 4 years and 91 days. Leona Cameo, I sentence you to a special custodial sentence of 6 years less 45 days. That consists of a custodial term of 4 years and 320 days and a 1 year additional license. Fatima Zainab Rajwani, I sentence you to a special custodial sentence of 5 years and 8 months less 45 days. That comprises a custodial term of 4 years and 200 days and a 1 year additional license. Samuel Corner, I sentence you to 3 years and 8 months imprisonment for the offence of inflicting grievous bodily harm. For the offence of criminal damage, I sentence you to a consecutive special custodial sentence of 5 years. That comprises a custodial term of 4 years and a 1 year additional license. The total sentence in your case is therefore 8 years and 8 months. And you may now be taken from the dock.
Yeah, so I was actually involved years ago in Oxford with the Trident Ploughshares people who had got broken into a BAE factory, smashed up a plane which was going to go to Indonesia and be used to kill people there in obviously criminal fashion, war crimes being, you know, they were just bombing them from the skies, any old person, even though there wasn't really any excuse for it. This is a Hawk aircraft, and they were just exonerated and let off. But we've managed to create a pro-Israeli legal system now, which treats these people, rather than heroes, as terrorists. Now, this is an obvious miscarriage of justice. The Jonathan Cook, the journalist, pointed out what should be obvious to millions of people is that actually it's this judge that should be going to jail.
Well, I couldn't agree more. I mean, people should really wake up. This is a clear sign of an authoritarian impulse in the British state. And obviously, I'm really sorry that these people are going to prison, but I suspect that they are all going to end up as MPs one day. And the judge may end up.
Well, I think
prison.
That is the interesting thing, is it? Often down the line, people like this are exonerated, aren't they?
That's right. Prisons are the universities of revolution. Always have been.
Yeah, so do you think this is going to do what the authorities and the establishment want it to do, the pro-Israeli, pro-genocide establishment, and dissuade anyone else from even thinking about doing anything similar?
Well, what may happen is people might do the same things, but may take steps to make sure they're not caught. Yep, that's the obvious way to get round it, isn't it? And smash the place up and make sure you run away before they catch you.
And what about ultimately, I mean, if this is allowed to continue and it comes to a war, you know, the genocide I'm talking about, and a wider war with other superpowers being involved, maybe it's just simply the writing on the wall, that factory's going to get bombed.
Yes, well, I mean, we're in a very, very febrile state, and the British state is fragile. It's not that strong in the big scheme of things, and you know, we haven't discussed this yet, but I mean, the seizure of the Russian tanker, which is on its way to India in the Channel, this is potentially war. You know, if we end up going to war with Russia and ending up fighting Iran on behalf of the Israelis, then I think a lot of younger people, like these young people, are not going to be happy, nor will I be.
One of the people protesting last Friday outside the court was the former boss of Friends of the Earth, Jonathan Porritt.
The judge in this case has made it very clear that he intends to sentence this as if it had been a terrorist offence when it wasn't. It was criminal damage. And this is just part of the government's massive efforts now to crush any opposition to what they stand for, which unfortunately is support for the Israeli Defence Forces as they carry out their genocide in Gaza, as they carry out literally limitless war crimes on the West Bank. And every single one of this cabinet, from Starmer downwards, is complicit now in that genocide. To stop those weapons of war, those drones, being exported to Israel, and I support them in that work, because they're not terrorists. The terrorists are, unfortunately, doing the job that they do in Gaza and in the British government.
That's Jonathan Porritt there, giving his point of view. I think he's been arrested several times, actually, for holding up these placards, I oppose genocide, I support Palestine action.
Yes, and as George Monbiot pointed out this week, these people are being sent down for years, 8 years, for terrorism, but the people who were burning people out of their houses in Belfast are going to be charged with, you know, criminal damage. Aren't they terrorists? They're burning people, they're trying to burn people to death. That's terrorism, isn't it? Why is Palestine action terrorism, that not terrorism?
Well, it does seem as if there's a little bit of a mismatch here in our court system. And I think, for me, it's always a good idea to go back and look at who appoints these judges, which is David Lammy at the Department for Justice. And also, of course, this is all countersigned by the King, that is Tampon Charlie. So I'd like to... I mean, this is a... We had for a long time, didn't we? This idea that the royal assent in the way that laws are made, that it goes through the House of Lords, the House of Commons, three times, the second, third reading, and then it goes for the royal assent, and that the King is customarily just signs it. Well, actually, this isn't really the case. We've found out, due to the brilliant work of journalists like Rob Evans at The Guardian, that and the, looking at these... I can't remember what they call it. Norman Baker talks about it quite a bit. Is that the King is constantly, in fact, even before it goes to the Lords or the Commons, the King is going through it, going, well, actually, this one affects me. Can you just put a black line through that?
Yeah, well, what we didn't know until it was discovered not that long ago was that the Crown actually intervenes at the very earliest stages of legislation to veto anything it doesn't like. And we didn't even know that they did that until it was exposed. But, I mean, that just goes to show that, you know, they have a great deal more power than over things like... Because what the things they used to veto was stuff that affected the finances of the Duchy of Lancaster or whatever. So that a lot of their, you know, are not having this... You know, in other words, it's actually... It's not... The Crown is just protecting its own assets by intervening.
Norman Baker's done a super job, actually. A really good job. He's also, by the way, this week got an article out about the... Gareth Williams, the GCHQ guy in a bag, who I think was most likely murdered because of his leaking. Apparently he helped hack a list of guest lists for an event, the private, very private event that Bill Clinton was attending. And of course the Americans are not going to be happy about that at all. And so maybe they just decided, you know, to do him over because of that. But anyway, Norman's done an excellent thing, because obviously this hasn't really been looked at all properly by the legal profession, all whom are appointed by the King, King's Counsel, etc. They're all King's Counsel nowadays. But anyway, so we heard a bit from David Dimbleby last week, but I noticed also that he did a completely passed me by this series. Many of you may have watched it on the BBC in the run-up to last Christmas, but it's called What's the Monarchy For? Bits and pieces of it are available still. It's still there on the iPlayer, just about. But David Dimbleby had a really good look at this whole idea of the Black Spider letters. And it's quite obvious for anyone that's looking, as they're trying to hide the amount of interest and influence that King Charles has over the ministers and the general direction of government policy. And when that government policy is genocidal, quite clearly, the buck stops with Tampon Charlie, doesn't it?
Young Prince Charles is a man with strong opinions.
A great deal of destructiveness has taken place in terms of throwing the baby out with the bathwater.
He doesn't just want to sit there and do nothing, cut the odd ribbon, have a cup of tea. He travels widely, talks to people from all corners of Britain.
Yes, of course, yes, I do my very best.
And he thinks of himself as giving an ear to those who feel ignored by politicians.
I've seen a lot, and I've been very touched by the way people have, you know, responded.
He begins to carve out a role for himself as unofficial spokesman for all kinds of issues.
It's just that I feel that certain things have to be said, and if you skirt round the issues all the time, how do we ever get anywhere in life? Do you know what I mean?
And Charles doesn't just talk about what he thinks.
I write a lot. You know, that is a very, I find, therapeutic exercise.
He writes over 2,000 letters a year, many to people at the heart of government.
Well, I was working as a special advisor in government, and I just had a recollection of one of these missives from then Prince Charles coming in. And I remember it being treated as though it was some sort of a holy writ. I mean, it wasn't quite on a silken pillow, but almost, and put to the top of the red box. And I just remember thinking at the time, that's astonishing. No one else, you know, whether it was a hospital or a major piece of public work or another minister even, would be treated in quite that same way.
If he had something to say, it's important that ministers should know about it. There is nothing on God's earth that says that he shouldn't.
Except he gets the privilege that no other citizen has of being on the top of the letters in the red box.
Yeah, well, fair enough.
Is it?
Yeah.
He wrote private letters. I don't think that's unreasonable.
Really?
No, I think that's perfectly proper.
Perfectly proper.
Perfectly proper. Well, you must assume that ministers are completely spineless. That if you have a government policy you want to push through, it doesn't matter if you get a letter from the Pope, you're still not going to change your policy.
Don't forget, this is not the occasional note dashed off. This is a sort of sustained industrial level over many, many years. It's an incredible weight of influence being brought to bear. And if the other letters that were sent over all these decades were treated in the same way as the one that I saw, then the suspicion must be that the minister paid immediate attention to them and may well then have, you know, changed their diaries or changed their minds as a result.
Supposing instead of writing memos, when he next met the minister, said, look, it's really dreadful in Bradford what's going on. I think you ought to look at it. Would you object to that, or would that be reasonable?
I think that is reasonable, because that is just part of his role, advising.
So hang on. So what's the difference between saying, minister, I think you ought to have a look at what's happening in Bradford, and writing a letter saying, look, have a look at what's happening in Bradford?
Because I think the example you give would be a one-off example of, I experienced this and I think you ought to know this, Secretary of State, compared to industrial-level lobbying around particular issues that one person has felt to be very important.
And I mean, is he meant to be shtum? Just go around something.
Well, up to a point, yes, actually. But I just think it raises important questions about how we're governed and how ministers work and access to decision-making from people that deserve to be heard.
Did you come at all years ago?
I came just before I was leader.
It was always known that Charles would sound off on his favourite subjects, but no one knew what he actually wrote, nor whether he had any influence. In 2005, under the Freedom of Information Act, a group of journalists asked to see what the heir to the throne was saying. Their requests eventually landed on the desk of Attorney General Dominic Grieve, who read the letters they'd asked for and decided not to publish them.
When I looked at the letters, it was clear to me that there was nothing in the letters that was were remotely improper. What he was doing was communicating with government ministers in confidence about matters which had been raised with him or which he had seen in the course of his public duties.
But why, if he was just doing a job that he was entitled to do, why shouldn't they be published?
In exactly the same way that there would be no publication if I, as a government minister, wrote a letter to another government minister.
But it sounds as though you think that the King and the Prince of Wales are entitled to interfere in government.
Not
to say what they think, to advocate. Well, why don't you do this? Why don't you do that?
They are.
And in a democracy, we're not allowed to know what they're saying.
Well, in a democracy, you're not allowed to know what ministers are saying to each other.
Yeah, but we can throw them out.
But at the same time, if you want to have the benefit of experience and advice being fed into government, it has to be in confidence. It may well be that you can interpret from those letters his own personal views. I think that's correct. And they are views which he would not wish to express in public.
Why?
Because of the need to maintain neutrality, public neutrality. But that doesn't...
Hang on. This is hypocrisy.
No, it's not.
You maintain neutrality in public, but in private, you say what you think to a minister and expect them to jump through the hoop.
There's no expectation in those letters of people jumping through the hoop.
But nevertheless, you thought publication would undermine his position of neutrality.
Yes,
it seems to me what you're saying there is he's not actually neutral, and publication would reveal that.
No.
Well, really?
No.
Anyway, well done, David Dimbleby. Still a little bit of fight in the old dog yet. But so, Martin, what he's explaining there is that actually there's a massive amount of influence that the monarch has, but they take great pains to make sure it's all hidden.
Well, that's right. So, obviously, when it gets exposed, they're not very happy, are they?
What I'll try and do over the next few weeks is have an extract from all of these three programmes from this series called... What is it called again? It's called What's the Monarchy For? From December last year, because it's an absolute treasure trove of the... And, of course, the implication here is that many of these government ministers are simply, like, they're lackeys, really. They're working for an establishment of some sort, whether it's the city or the royalty, not us.
Well, I mean, if you think about British history, English history, it's been a constant struggle against the crown... and, you know, Parliament and the wider people. That's what the history of England has always been about. Still is.
Yeah, so the BBC is still doing some good stuff. And, I mean, they've slowly been turned into this complete, like, mind-numbing thing. And that's happening even more this week. It's just been announced.
The World Tonight on Radio 4, the half-hour midnight news, and Crossing Continents are all to be axed as part of the BBC's latest round of cuts. The corporation announced in April that it needed to make £500 million in savings. The National Union of Journalists said the proposed cuts would be devastating for audiences and communities everywhere. Our media correspondent David Sillitoe has this report.
Beginning each evening with the sound of Big Ben, the Midnight Bulletin has been part of Radio 4's daily schedule from its beginning in 1967.
BBC News at midnight.
The World Tonight followed soon after, in 1970. It's now going to be replaced with the World Service's News Hour, and the Midnight Bulletin is to go altogether. So too are Crossing Continents, The Law Show, Antisocial, and Moneybox Live. The BBC's acting head of news, Jonathan Munro, said it was a matter of concentrating resources on the bigger radio audiences earlier in the day.
It's really important that we protect the biggest range audiences, and they tend to be in the mornings, programmes like the Today programme. So we've chosen to take out The World Tonight, and I know that's a very difficult decision. But we make another programme called News Hour an hour earlier for the World Service. So by moving News Hour to 10 o'clock UK time, we can make one programme for two audiences, and that is obviously more efficient.
And this is just part of a wider £500 million package of cuts. The corporation's Director General, Matt Britton, said he was reviewing all of the BBC's portfolio of channels and services. John Sailing of the National Union of Journalists says this is a moment for the government to intervene.
These proposed cuts are going to be devastating for audience communities everywhere. And what's worse is we know there's more to come. It's clear charter renewal is not going to come soon enough to stop these cuts. And that's why we're calling on the government to urgently intervene.
Altogether, up to around 150 hours of TV and video content and 450 hours of radio and audio are to be cut, with up to 2,000 jobs going by the end of this particular savings programme.
So there you go, a little announcement on the BBC that the BBC is killing off some of its most important news bulletin. This is, of course, as I was saying earlier, Martin, this is a time for a party down at Rupert Murdoch headquarters.
Yes, well, I mean, obviously, there's the BBC is regarded as a problem by the Murdoch-type people, and they're gradually being dealt with, aren't they? They're having their legs broken, having their testicles crushed.
Everyone likes to have a go at the BBC, don't they? And, of course, there are all sorts of problems with it. I mean, I remember that awful woman from BBC Scotland saying on Newsround, saying to the children, oh, it's OK, there's never been any problems with vaccines injuring people, children. Don't even... And, of course, the vaccine for COVID... that children were not being affected by COVID. It was older people. And so there was a sort of massive perversion in what the BBC, well, they were basically just spinning for the, but anyway, everyone was kind of doing that. Many of the commercial organisations too. But the idea of a public service broadcaster, a state broadcaster, this is quite important, isn't it? For some reason, I've always ended up working for these state broadcasters, whether it's RT, Press TV, for the Russian state and the Iranian state, and the BBC here too. But they're a very different character, aren't they?
There's nothing wrong with having public service broadcasting. I mean, the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, which would be the equivalent of the BBC, it's not funded through licence fee, it's funded by the Australian government. Now, the problem with having a government-funded thing is it's always going to be slightly biased if the government is paying for it.
Of course, but the idea really here is that as governments are taken over by the bankers, so are their broadcasters.
Well, what they're determined to do is control people's news. And, you know, people like Murdoch are quite clear about what they want to do. They're very pro-Israel. They want to push that agenda. And, of course, the Israeli state, which is largely funded by the US taxpayer, they're determined to control the agenda. And people like Alex Karp at Palantir, he is actually embedded with the Israeli military. And they want to control the what people think because they want to wage war. And, of course, this has always been the case. In World War II, everybody had their own broadcasters broadcasting away, didn't they? And, where's the truth? It's obviously a bit elusive in those circumstances, isn't it?
It is, and another really so. I mentioned at the very start about the sad death of Roger Cook, the excellent journalist from the BBC Radio 4 Checkpoint programme, who then moved on to Central Television to do, for a decade or so, the Cook Report. Notable for its being the biggest ever ratings for any current affairs programme. Marty, I'm sure you saw some of those Cook reports in the 1990s.
I did, but I can't. I don't remember that much.
You remember
about
what
it.
He was doing?
I never used to watch telly at all.
It's what's called a journalistic sting, where he would go in, do some investigating, and then say, "Yeah, but you're a drug dealer. You're stealing cars," and he would actually put it on the person on camera. There'd be a cameraman standing next to Roger Cook, and there would also be another cameraman on the other side of the road in case the criminal smashed the camera up or smashed up Roger. So there was a sort of chain of cameras all watching each other to see how the person was going to react. And largely, the great thing about Roger was that he did what the police should do but weren't doing.
Well, I mean, you know, more power to his elbow. In fact, when you talk about the 1990s, I wasn't even living here. I was living in Poland, so I certainly wasn't watching TV.
No, okay. Well, anyway, I watched it, and we will be talking a little bit about, and we'll be hearing from Roger himself, the interview that I did with him after we just hear an announcement made on ITV this week.
Tributes have been paid to pioneering investigative journalist Roger Cook, who's died after a short illness. He was 83. He's best known for his series The Cook Report, which was produced by Central Television in Birmingham. Lee Comley reports.
Roger Cook, I'd like to talk to you about money laundering.
What?
I want to know why you're acting as a pig.
During his work, he never received a warm welcome. These reactions perhaps best show the impact Roger Cook had. Confronting criminals, terrorists, con artists face to face, but instilling fear in those he approached. His journalistic style was groundbreaking. He changed what a doorstep interview could be. But with it came death threats, dislocated shoulders, cracked ribs, and broken fingers.
Well, that was an interesting interview.
He seemed to accept that these were part of the job. Roger Cook had a fearless approach, no matter who he appeared to be up against.
Roger Cook redefined television journalism. At its peak, The Cook Report was the most popular current affairs programme on TV. But his real legacy is inspiring generations of journalists to chase the truth, hold power to account, and have the bravery to confront the baddies head on.
He was passionate about the facts, passionate about the truth. Roger believed the truth was worth the price he paid for it. One of his main qualities was his loyalty. So many of his colleagues are now shocked and saddened that he's died. And here we are, 30 years on, still quite a tight group with very fond memories of him.
He passed away this weekend at the age of 83. His family have said, alongside a distinguished and award-winning career in journalism, Roger was first and foremost a beloved husband and father. He will be deeply missed by all of us. Roger Cook's fearless hunt for the truth helped push and inspire the journalists that followed, ensuring that his work and influence will live on.
Yes, they will. And it's so lovely that because people have uploaded these editions of the Cook Report, which had been lost by Carlton Television, supposedly, burnt in a fire, that various people have got these things on video. And over the years, they've uploaded them now. There's a dedicated channel online on YouTube for Roger Cook's ex-programmes, which the ones which I talked to him about, because I interviewed him, 13 years ago, back in September 2012 at his home, and spoke to him about some of these. So let's have a little dip back into that interview. I'll put the full version of this up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, because nowhere have I seen the role of the News of the World in destroying Roger Cook's career in a criminal fashion, taking his programme off the airwaves back in around about 2000 through a bunch of complete and utter hatchet jobs and smear campaigns in over several weeks in the News of the World, which Roger then explained to me when I met him in Wiltshire.
I'm Roger Cook. I used to front the Cook Report on ITV and had a very large run-in with the News of the World in about 2000 when they decided, I think probably out of professional jealousy, that they would have me. And they managed to persuade a couple of very junior ex-employees, who seemed to be in it for the money, to invent stories. And one in particular, who was a former specialty cameraman, did undercover work, took £27,000 from them for making up stories, which the film he'd took would disprove anyway, although he was far too fly to give them the film, and they were too interested in getting the story to ask for it. Anyway, after about 2 years and millions of pounds expended, they settled out of court, and after 10 or 12 pages of libel, three of them front pages, during which they accused me of faking everything they'd ever done, they were forced to admit that the Independent Television Commission, which was the regulator then, was right when, after an 18-month investigation, they'd said we'd not broken the regulatory code, we'd done nothing wrong, we hadn't deceived anybody, and we were right. They had to concede about a year on, when the cost was still further escalating, that the ITC was right. And there was an apology, if you can call it that, on page 38, covering 2.5 column inches. And the Press Complaints Commission, for whom I have no time either, thought that was what they called due prominence.
Your programme, The Cook Report, did use some fairly unorthodox methods.
I don't think they're unorthodox at all. We were first to use them. We would use stings, for example, carefully set up stings. The difference between what we did and what tabloids did was that we would only cause people to take part in these stings to demonstrate what it was they did for a living. Known fraudsters, known IRA or UDA fundraisers, for example, they would be encouraged by, obviously, greed or sometimes ego and sometimes both, to present themselves for the camera, thinking they were going to do something else. Now, that's very different from Jack Straw's son at one stage, who thought he was going to get his leg over an attractive Mirror reporter, supplied her with a very small quantity of cannabis, after which he was portrayed as a drug dealer, which he certainly wasn't. So there's a big difference. I mean, we were exposing major criminals. We were exposing, for example, as I said, fundraisers for the UDA, one of whom tried to extort money from me sitting in the back of a car carrying a gun, and went down for 10 years after the film was shown in court, and it was the only evidence that was given apart from my own, because people in the province of Northern Ireland were a bit scared, naturally, about coming out and talking about the paramilitaries. So there was a big difference. They'd accused us, the News of the World, at one stage they said we'd faked everything that we'd ever done. how they could possibly prove that in court when we did 130-odd programmes, none of which were faked. They were all very, very carefully lawyered. We had our own code of ethics, which I wrote way back in the days of Checkpoint on BBC Radio 4, which we stuck to. And we had a full-time barrister. No other programmes ever had that. So we were very careful about what we did, very ethical, but they said we weren't. The Independent Television Commission were asked by the News of the World to do an investigation. They made a formal complaint, and when they didn't get the result they wanted, they dismissed it as a whitewash. Eventually they did have to give in. Didn't do me much good, though, because I'd come off the air, as ITV did, unlike the BBC, until I'd proved myself innocent, although they'd said, we don't believe you've done anything wrong, and we'll welcome you back, said the director of programs, with open arms, when this is all over and the dust is settled. When that had happened, he wasn't there anymore. And the new incumbent thought I was old-fashioned, expensive, and a bit of a dinosaur, really. So I went on to do other things.
Now, ITV runs on audiences and advertising, and you were bringing in something like 10 million per programme audiences for their advertisers. I mean, surely it doesn't make any commercial sense for them to say we don't want the Cook Report back if they've got a 10 million audience coming with that.
You would think that's the case, but I think they didn't like the fact that it was hard work for them. It wasn't just the programme, it was the aftermath. We had to have a sort of after-sales department to make sure that when we were sued, which we often were, we were well covered and could defend it rapidly and robustly, which we did do. We were sued lots of times, never successfully. The programme actually came off the air around 2000.
Around 2000, and that's the time of this four-week News of the World sting. One of the programmes, for example, that you did was eerily prescient in that you were looking at the possibility of hijacking aircraft in the United States in the wake of the 1993 World Trade Center bombing. And, of course, the year after your programme came off, then we had the September the 11th attacks. Now, I wonder whether you watched those attacks and thought, we told you so.
No, we did. But then the people we got the information from said, I told you so, too. We got information from the Philippines that a man called Ramzi Yusuf, who'd been the mastermind of the first World Trade Center attack, was living there and had been chased out of his flat when a bomb went off in the flat. He was making a bomb using some homemade explosive called TAPT. When he fled, he left his computer behind, and on that computer were all the plans to fly planes into the Pentagon and into the World Trade Center and places like that. And also further plans, not only to assassinate the Pope, that got nowhere near getting off the ground, but also to fly planes into each other. And this was the basis of the shoe bomber plan. So it was all there. And the Filipinos, the head of the Manila police, a wonderfully named man called Hermogenes J. Ebdane Jr., gave them all this material, and they dismissed it as the product of a febrile imagination being offered to them by a straw-chewing hick. So we knew what was going to go on, and a number of people in the States also knew, on the fringes of officialdom, who all said, look, this is going to happen. And in the same program, we, with the help of Dr. Jim Swire, whose daughter Flora was killed in Lockerbie, managed to smuggle onto various planes bombs, fake bombs, but with a substance on board which had the same X-ray signature as Semtex, and we got it through 23 airports. And in one, the worst airport of the lot, the stuff went through the scanner with the operative looking the other way with his feet on the desk reading Sports Illustrated, and our cameraman and a researcher got on the plane with no boarding pass and no ticket. That was Boston Logan Airport. Where did the 9/11 bombers leave from?
Well, I mean, what he's saying there, obviously, he's under the impression that the deep state in the US were given warnings about all these attacks, but they didn't take them seriously. I put it to you, Tony, that in actual fact, they knew all about this because they were running the whole thing. I mean, the guy who bombed the World Trade Center in 1993, he got the explosives from the FBI. Yeah, the FBI gave him the explosives.
Well, it's also, if this thing was being planned, they didn't want someone like Roger Cook spiking their guns, did they?
No, they didn't. And, of course, it's not just that they were incompetent. They are actually guilty. And of course, we've covered everything to do with 9/11.
What about John O'Neill? I mean, John O'Neill was another guy that said, "Hang on a minute, you know what's going on here?" Well, he was in charge of the FBI. He was your sort of modern day in 2001 version of J. Edgar Hoover. And
no, he was second in command, so he
was he number two? Anyway, he resigned because he said, "Look, there's all this going on. No one's investigating it." So he is up there in heaven with Roger right now.
One of the programmes that you did towards the end, Roger, was around the idea of Russian and Soviet soldiers that hadn't been paid for a long time. The problem was that they were actually still on nuclear bases guarding nuclear weapons. So can you tell us about that programme? Because there were some pretty scary revelations, weren't there?
Well, it wasn't just the soldiers. It was the scientists who, before Perestroika, had been up the top of the tree, well paid. Afterwards, they weren't paid at all. So to keep their families alive, you can understand why they did it, although it was appalling, they were stealing nuclear material and selling it into the black market via the Russian mafia, who really are tough. As one of the KGB people, or ex-KGB people we spoke to, said, they make the Sicilian mafia look like Enid Blyton. Anyway, we, with the help of a Russian journalist who ended up having a nervous breakdown and turning into an alcoholic during the process of making this program, we made contact with members of the mafia and went round to this extraordinary run-down maisonette in the back streets of Moscow, where we were offered, first of all, a sample, and it turned out to be weapons-grade plutonium because we had it tested by Minatom, the Russian equivalent of the Atomic Energy Authority. And the guy went grey as he tested this stuff and said it really is the real stuff. We had a very proper English translator who started to blush, and I said, "What's this man saying?" And he said, "You've been handling this stuff, and it's not properly packaged. If I were you, when I went back home, I'd go and have yourself tested, because your balls will probably glow in the dark." Fortunately, they didn't. Anyway, we went to this place, and the second time round, and we had organised, and to show you how thorough we are, we actually had, on an overnight purchase, a lot of money, I mean tens of millions of pounds, on deposit in a bank, a crooked bank, in Gibraltar. So when they checked us, as we knew they did, in the little time frame we gave them, the money was there. So we were able to buy what was going to be 6 kilos of weapons-grade plutonium, which we were going to turn into a dirty bomb. You don't have to be clever and make it go fissionable. All you have to do is disperse it. So you stick some gelignite round it, take it to the top of a tall building and blow it up. And we had calculated, with the help of a scientist who used to be in charge of the SALT II talks, that if you did that at the top of a building in Manhattan, bearing in mind the half-life of this material, you wouldn't be able to go into Manhattan for 26,000 years. So it was a pretty frightening prospect. Anyway, when we got back from, very happily, having got all this on film with concealed cameras, to our hotel, we played it back and discovered that a sound lead must have come adrift because we'd made a silent movie. So we had to go back. Now, the first time had been very interesting because they'd kept this stuff, would you believe, took us out into the lobby, and there in a cupboard under the stairs, next to the Hoover, was this fissionable material, which we were going to buy. Anyway, we went back again, and unfortunately, he'd thought we were going back because we were very keen, and we'd represented ourselves as emissaries of a seedy Middle Eastern regime. They were very keen because they thought we were, and we wanted to make a bomb, they said. And they said, "Don't worry, we can save you the trouble. We've got a SAM-20 nuclear missile warhead in the back garden under canvas." And they did. Now, you can't, now this is just quintessentially bizarre, but you can't say, "I don't like this game, I'm taking my bat and ball and going home," because at that stage they shoot you. So we then used this fact that we wouldn't have the money to buy a ready-made bomb, we'd have to go away again, and scuttled around to the FSB, because I think I said the KGB as was, and these people were arrested on the day, and as far as I know, they're still road-testing thermal underwear somewhere in the Russian Antarctic.
But there's a really serious edge to this, isn't there, Roger? Because we're being told that the Iranians are trying to sort of start from scratch with uranium, make plutonium in reactors, and potentially make a bomb. And what you proved was that because of the collapse of the Soviet Union, you actually proved that these SS-20 warheads, I mean, these are about 10 times the power of a Hiroshima bomb were available on the black market.
They were, and for, well, lots of money, but comparatively compared to what they would have cost, not very much money. Yes, they were available, and that was pretty frightening. And even if you just got, as we had initially planned to do, just some of the material to make a dirty bomb, and bear in mind, a bomb that would do what I'd suggested to Manhattan was small enough to fit into a briefcase. And the Russians have thought of this themselves. And out of the 70 they made, 23 went missing, and they don't know where they ever went.
In your view, would it have been possible for the Iranian Secret Service at the time to have got hold of one of these?
Oh, come on, if a journalist can do it, certainly a Secret Service man could.
Because one of the interesting things that you always hear from Iran at the moment is, we have no intention of manufacturing a bomb. They put it in that particular way.
Well, it might be because they've already got one, who knows?
So that's Roger Cook speaking to me back in 2012. So much to think and talk about there. He's talking about 6 kilos of weapons-grade plutonium, the minimum you need, actually, to make a nuclear bomb out of plutonium. Is actually 4 kilos. So this stuff was going around on the black market in the 1990s. You were actually over in Eastern Europe in that time. Is it feasible that what he says is true? I mean, it's there on the program.
Well, I mean, he obviously carried out an investigation that showed that it was true. I mean, that in that period, the Russian state was in meltdown. But of course, what he also obviously cooperated with the Russian authorities. So he told the FSB what's going on.
That's quite a good idea, isn't
yes,
it?
And, yeah. And of course, they jumped all over it. And now, of course, the Russian state is much stronger. The Siloviki, which means the security people, basically dealt with the mafia were in charge when Yeltsin was running things. Semen Mogilevich and all the other mafia guys were very, very powerful, and the economy was collapsing all through the stupidity of trying to apply Margaret Thatcherism to the Soviet Union. And of course, we're lucky that we got through that. And of course, the consequences are still following.
What we need, of course, is lots more Roger Cooks. I think actually of Andy Roberts sometimes when I see him doing his deep investigations into government corruption, which we're not seeing hardly anywhere. In fact, even the programs like Panorama that are supposed to be investigating things, they're really hardly scratching the surface. So we need more Rogers, please. And this is a final little excerpt from that interview I did back in September 2012 with Roger, which looks at some of his other programs.
Another program that you did towards the end of the Cook Report was one about satanic abuse. Now, this is people like Private Eye will say this doesn't exist. What did you find out about it?
Well, as far as we could see, it did. I mean, it wasn't as widespread as some people tried to say, but on the other hand, those who said it didn't exist were clearly wrong. We centred on a bizarre shop called The Sorcerer's Apprentice, run by a weird man called Chris Bray, who sold all the appurtenances for conducting satanic ceremonies, but also served as a distribution point for literature advocating satanic abuse and child abuse, and a meeting place for such people. It was in Yorkshire somewhere. The program went out, and he complained to the Broadcasting Complaints Commission, which was then the regulator, and he was just about the only one who was turned away at the door. You know, he'd made absolutely outrageous complaints, and he was found against. He still went on his website, publicizing my address, inviting his supporters to come and punish me as they saw fit, and claiming that he had been found entirely right by the Broadcasting Complaints Commission when he hadn't, and that ITV had to apologise on the air and publish a full apology in TV Times, none of which was true. And as far as I know, he's still mad enough to be doing that today.
Well, going back to where we started with the news of the world, what are your thoughts about the Leveson inquiry and the expose of phone hacking and some quite serious criminal activity? Just in the news this week is information suggesting that burglaries were ordered from the newsroom.
Oh, I fully believe it. I mean, they were totally out of control. When I was done over by the news of the world, my little local exchange wasn't digital, so there's no footprint to prove it. But my phone, I believe, and so does my lawyer believe, was not just hacked, but tapped. Hacking is just picking up messages from somebody's mobile. Tapping is listening in real time to both sides of a conversation. And we know this because a man calling himself Steve rang up during the course of the legal action we were taking against the News of the World, saying that he was an ex-News of the World reporter, he was on my side, and he could offer me all kinds of information, we should have a chat. And it became very clear that he was on a fishing expedition, sponsored, I believe, by the News of the World, because he knew some stuff that nobody else did know. For example, he knew that the News of the World's major witness had come to us and completely retracted his testimony. Now, the only people who knew that at that stage were my solicitor and me, because it had only happened the day before and we'd had a phone conversation about it. There's no doubt in my mind that they tapped my phone. But as I said, no digital footprint. It's only circumstantial evidence. But in this case, I believe it's good enough for me. And it was a very serious offence, far more serious than hacking, because there were people attempting to pervert the course of an ongoing high-profile libel case. And if they do that sort of thing, they do anything. I've seen people talking, heard people talking about break-ins to get evidence, even break-ins to steal the picture of a deceased person, the victim of a road accident or a mining disaster or something, off the mantelpiece of the bereaved in order to be the only ones with a picture. I mean, no morals whatsoever. So the sort of stuff that came out during Leveson was no surprise at all.
So that's final of the three clips from the longer interview. Put that up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk later with the glorious, wonderful Roger Cook. Really, really came into his own in the 1990s. Now, this sort of investigative journalism just does simply not happen anymore, partly, Martin, because it's an expensive type of television to do, and advertising, of course, is going elsewhere on the internet, Googling, that sort of thing. But also because the TV companies are really, there is nothing, as there was in the old days with Central, for example. They had part of their license was to make programs like this. They had to do this sort of investigative journalism as part of getting their license. No, that was all gotten rid of back in the noughties.
Yeah, well, I mean, any investigative journalism is going to be trying to get up the down escalator, isn't it? I talked to a guy who's an investigative journalist for The Guardian years ago, and he said, well, of ten investigations that I'm carrying out, only one will ever end up in the newspaper. So you have to do loads and loads of investigation, and often you can't really use the stuff at the end for legal reasons and so on. So it's expensive. That's the thing about proper investigative journalism. It's not cheap.
So I'll put also a link up to Roger Cook's channel and those programs, the one about the dirty bomb and the satanic abuse one. I'll put those on our show page at thisweek.org.uk later. Thank you.
might have guessed from the sound of that opening processional, this is music with a very long history, one that stretches right back to the early years of Christianity. But the performers we heard there, La Capella Real de Catalunya, directed by Jordi Savall, didn't dig the music out from some dusty, forgotten archive. El Cant de la Sibilla is a sacred drama that's still performed regularly in the modern era every Christmas in churches across Spain, as it has been for many centuries, very much a living tradition. The music is a mixture of ancient plain chant and polyphony from later centuries that's accumulated over time, evolving into different versions in different places. The version we heard comes from Valencia. All of it is attributed to my current composer of the week, Anonymous. During this week, I've been exploring the idea that the designation Anonymous can represent many different ideas. Today, Anonymous is a way for us to look beyond the composers and ask, when a work's creator is unknown, who else comes to the fore in its story? In recognition of its cultural importance, the Song of the Sibyl was declared an intangible cultural heritage of humanity by UNESCO in 2010. You may be familiar with the Sibyls from some of the monumental figures Michelangelo depicted around the center of the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel. They're pagan mythological figures who prophesy the end of the world, adapted by Christianity in the Middle Ages as a metaphor for the Last Judgment. In the liturgical drama, The Song of the Sibyl, the second coming of Christ is heralded. Despite attempts to suppress it, notably in the aftermath of the Council of Trent, it survived into the present day. The authors of The Song of the Sibyl are unknown, another anonymous. But listening to this music, we're reminded not of those lost names, but the legions of musicians, singers, church leaders, and communities who've kept this tradition through the centuries, every bit as important to the story of this work as some forgotten composer. In a performance, the singer, carrying a sword, walks up to the altar, escorted by altar boys carrying candles. The singer bows to the crucifix, turns around, and begins the song. The slow pace of the music gives it a sense of timelessness. What one writer has suggested might be the most haunting apocalyptic sound you will ever hear. Thank you.
a song to sing, to help me cope with anything. If you see the wonder of a fairy tale, you can take the future, even if you fail. I believe in angels, something good in everything I see. I believe in angels, when I know the time.
So from 1979, that's ABBA to begin with. And before that, what you heard was now, I mean, I love that. It, particularly since it's a medieval apocalyptic thing. This is composer of the week on Radio 3 this week is somebody called Anonymous. And so there's been some brilliant stuff on there, all sorts of interesting bits and pieces. That one is called El Cant de la Sibila. That's D-E-L-A-S-I-B-I-L-A, and that is Spanish, about 1,000 years old or so. And so welcome back to the Bristol Politics Show with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. We're also joined on the line by John Harris, who's an author on about Rudolf Hess. John, can you hear me?
I can hear you loud and clear.
Great. So, John, what I thought would be useful to get you on to talk about is just to sort of spell things out for people who are not familiar with this. There was Rudolf Hess was the second in command to Adolf Hitler in the Second World War. He'd actually known him very well for many years in the Nazi Party, and he appears in many of the Nazi films, for example, a very tall man. He was also, I remember reading, he didn't eat the same sort of food as Hitler, and he wasn't a vegetarian. So there was this sort of ostracism in a weird way. When they were all eating meals, the top Nazis, Hess would go and sort of sit on a different table because he wasn't a veggie. But then we had this bizarre situation in 1941, which I don't know if anyone has properly really explained it. On May the 10th that year, Rudolf Hess got into an ME-110 aircraft, and he flew off late in the afternoon, early evening, and into the night, trying to secretly go to Scotland. Now, this was, for those that aren't familiar with the war, it's just about maybe 6 weeks before what's called now Barbarossa, and what's at the time by the Nazis called Barbarossa, which is the surprise invasion of the Soviet Union, which then very much brought the Soviet Union into the war. There'd been this Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact, which had kept the Germans and the Russians as friends up until that very day, the 22nd of June. So 6 weeks before that, Rudolf Hess got into an aircraft and flew over to the UK. He clearly thought, I'm not sure what he said to other people, but he clearly thought he was going to be able to do some sort of peace deal. So anyway, can you just, I know you've been researching this for many years, just sum up what you make of this incredible flight in the middle of the Second World War, just before the surprise invasion of the Soviet Union by Nazi Germany?
Certainly. So firstly, I think your synopsis is very accurate, what you've actually said. Hess was Hitler's oldest confidant, or certainly one of them. And unlike Hitler, Hitler saw that Britain was bowed. He'd bombed Britain virtually into submission. And he saw Britain not as a major threat, because clearly they were not in a position to launch any offensive action alongside his action against Russia. Rudolf Hess, I think, was more cautious, and he realised the strength or the latent power of the British Empire and was basically trying to do something about it so that Germany didn't once again fall into the trap of fighting a war on two fronts. Hitler in Mein Kampf actually says that's why Germany lost the First World War. And lo and behold, spring of 41, Germany had got herself back into that same position. So Hess was trying his hardest to prevent a repetition of the First World War, probably very sensitive. But what I think most people don't know is that it was far from an unheralded trip. So the German communique, after Hess had flown and crashed, the German propaganda machine clicked into action, and they clearly had to explain this extraordinary action without alerting Stalin. Because clearly, if Hess had really gone to make a peace, or if Hess had flown to Scotland with the view to making a peace, Stalin might well have been alerted to the fact that, well, why would Germany want to make a peace? What comes next? And Britain, not surprisingly, had been telling Stalin all through the spring of 1941 what was about to happen. But still, Hess felt it was his duty to go and try and do a deal, if there was a deal there to be done. but it could all have been an illusion. So the British intelligence services were certainly aware of Hess's desperate need to make a peace on behalf of the Nazi state. And Hess had been inveigled in peace talks and negotiations really since August the 31st, 1940. And there had been various initiatives throughout the autumn and winter of 1940, which culminated in the flight in May, on May the 10th, 1941. But that is not to say that... So the official story that the Nazi Party put out was that Rudolf Hess had gone mad, stolen a plane, and flown to the enemy. But that was really for Joseph Stalin's consumption, because I don't think anybody in Germany particularly believed it. I'm sure Stalin didn't particularly believe it, but Hitler had to say something, and that was the official line. The truth, however, that we've been trying to uncover for the last 40 years is somewhat different.
Yeah, so one of the things I'd like you to clarify, if you can, is because there are lots of stories. I mean, I found this when looking into the disappearance of Hitler's private secretary, Martin Bormann, back in 1945, right at the very end of the Second World War. He kind of vanishes. Nobody really seems to know where he is. A Bristol journalist, Stuart Stephen, who was by then working at the Daily Express, had a front page lead saying Martin Bormann found. This is in 1972 over in Buenos Aires, which was then quickly countermanded by a big media campaign saying, no, we found his body. He's not definitely not over there. So there's obviously a lot of obfuscation going on here. And when it seems that people start getting to the truth, lots of books get published, which are, so for example, with the Bormann business, we got lots of books then being published about, oh, Hitler survived the war. He went to there and he went there. He was doing this, that, and everything else, really to just sort of steer people away from looking at this one book, Op JB, and another book by an American, Paul Manning, Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, which explains what had happened to Bormann, and he'd been aided. And so I think, when you started publishing your stuff, we've also had since quite a lot of, and possibly even at the same time or even before, lots of different stories about what happened with the Messerschmitt 110 when it was heading over towards the west coast of Scotland. It had went up the North Sea, and Hess then turned to the west and was hoping to land, I imagine. But anyway, he was a bit late and it was getting very dark. Obviously, the RAF are not going to help him find where he's trying to look for. But there have been different stories about what happened, whether he crashed, whether he bailed out, whether he landed. Can you just take us through what you think really happened?
Yeah, for sure. So far from somebody stealing a plane and flying to the enemy, the Hess flight was meticulously planned. He had been training for some while in the Messerschmitt 110, which at that time, Tony, was one of the fastest planes in the world. So if somebody that had no experience just jumped in a plane of that power, well, I don't think he'd have gone very far at all. I think he'd have probably crashed into the nearest hangar. He'd been training since Christmas 1940 in that plane. And more importantly, the thing that we've discovered is that he was using the state-of-the-art German radio navigation system, which was a system called Electra, which used radio beams to locate his position across the North Sea. Whilst Germany had got good navigational beam radar, the Brits were far ahead of defensive radar. But Hess was using the latest system, which was, as I say, called Electra. And for any of your listeners that are of a naval persuasion, after the war, that system was used as, and it was called Consol, and it was used until the 1990s when satellite navigation systems came into play. So this was real cutting-edge navigation. And straight away, the moment that Hess is using a tried and tested system like that, It means that the solo flight of a madman story goes straight away out of the window. And as you say, the Hess affair has been littered with nonsense. So was Hess in Spandau a doppelganger? Well, no, he wasn't, because there's DNA evidence to support that. Was the Hess plane that took off from Augsburg the same one as crashed in Scotland? That's a more difficult question, and it probably the answer to that is no, because he landed en route and refilled not for fuel but for oil, because the Messerschmitt 110 had got two huge engines. They were each 1,000 horsepower apiece, and they used what was called a total loss oil system, which meant that they consumed oil at the rate of between 5 and 9 litres an hour each. And behind the engine, there were 35-litre oil tanks. So a 110 could only fly for between 4 and 5 hours, not for fuel reasons, but for oil reasons. And that's how we started to piece together what was actually happening. But anyway, Hess gets set for the English stroke Scottish coast. He flies in virtually at sea level over sea houses and the Farne Isles, goes across central Scotland until he goes to the Clyde estuary, and then doubles back.
So hang on just a second. Why wasn't he intercepted by the Royal Air Force?
Well, he was. So at Accrington, they put up a Spitfire with a chap called Pocock as pilot. Pocock went as quickly as he could to 15,000 feet, because that was normal entry height into the UK by the Germans. But Hess knew that was going to happen, so he went in at sea level. So Pocock went high, Hess went low, and the two were never destined to meet at all. And to be fair, the part of the coast from Newcastle up to Berwick-upon-Tweed was some of the least defended airspace in the British Isles at that time. That having been said, Hess had to be rather careful where he came across the coast, because if he went too low, he'd have come in over the Newcastle air defences. Newcastle was heavily defended. And if he went too high, he would run the risk of coming in over the Edinburgh air defences at McMurray and East Fortune on the Berwickshire coast. So he hit quite a small window, and I'm not going to use the word token, because that means that it wasn't intended. I'm quite sure that if Pocock saw Hess, he would have tried to have shot him down. But the reality was, he was never likely to meet Hess. So Hess got across the coast unmolested, went straight across the middle of lowland Scotland, over Dungavel House, which many people think was the intended target. But if it was, he wouldn't have gone over it at 4,000 feet. He'd have attempted to land.
Okay, just a second, because first of all, that Spitfire is going to have real trouble catching up with a Messerschmitt 110 if it's going along at high speed. But then also, we need to know what was his actual... How was he able to know where he was? It's getting really dark at this point.
It was getting dark, and that was his problem. His radar system had let him down over the North Sea. Now, whether that was due to him not understanding the finer points of the radar system, but in 1950, he wrote a letter to his wife, Ilse, and he said that the radar system let him down at, open inverted commas, the decisive moment, close inverted commas. And the decisive moment was when he had to turn left to make his approach to the Scottish stroke English coast. So that's why he was late, because he doubled round again to check his bearings, and he was 40 minutes late. And that 40 minutes was absolutely crucial, because it was the difference between landing in the light, albeit at dusk, and not being able to land at in the darkness. So Richard Wilborn and I have spent two or three May the 10th up in Scotland just to ascertain the light conditions at that time. And even that is not straightforward, because in the war, Britain had what was called double summertime. We're on summertime at the moment, which is GMT plus one. And during the wartime, we had GMT plus two, so that it was lighter at night and darker in the mornings. So just trying to find the light conditions on May the 10th, 41, has been quite challenging. But we believe that 40 minutes period, which he spent doubling back over the North Sea, meant that his chances of actually landing the plane wherever he was intending to land had disappeared.
Right. So what actually happened? Did the aircraft, if he bailed out, of course, that aircraft is going to carry on all on its own and eventually crunch.
Yeah, well, this is the absolutely extraordinary part of this story. So the thing that we know for sure is that the plane crashed at 7 minutes past 11 on May the 10th, 1941. We know where it crashed as well. It crashed at just outside Evesham in Renfrewshire in Scotland. But what is more difficult is that the official story that came out was that Hess had parachuted. His plane had been going at sea level over the Clyde. He doubles back over ground to get height. And then when the plane gets to 4,000 feet, he attempts to bail out to parachute down. This is what we believe a very unlikely story for the following reasons. First of all, Hess had never parachuted out of a plane before, and it's almost an act of suicide to try and do that if you've never practiced it. Secondly, the only person that saw the parachute is Davy McLean, the ploughman, who propaganda said had arrested him at the end of a pitchfork. And C, the plane wreckage that exists to this day. So if any of your listeners want to go to East Fortune, they can see an engine from the Hess plane. If they wish to go to the Imperial War Museum at Duxford, they can see an engine from the plane and the fuselage. And if anybody's seen the effect of a plane crash, it's pretty horrific. A lot of these planes that crash are 40 foot under the ground. The engines and the fuselage in the museum look as if they are virtually brand new. They're not scarred in any way at all, particularly, or they look as if they've been subjected to a crash landing rather than a crash.
Yeah. So what you're hinting at here is it's a forced landing, and it must be a very difficult thing to do in the dark.
Well, it is, but at that point in the war, parachutes were reasonably recent. They only came out as safety devices at the back end of the First World War. They were pretty crude pretty crude devices. I think the Germans had cribbed the English Irving parachute as a design, and it was a fairly crude device. And typically, a pilot would always prefer to stay with the plane rather than leave the plane. So that's another point that would infer that there was a crash landing rather than a parachute jump. But the real killer point to our mind is if you parachute out of a plane and that plane then is allowed to take its own course, unaided by a pilot who is no longer with it, what do you think the chances are that that plane would crash in the same field as the parachutist landed in? So the plane crashed in a field adjacent to Flores Farm at Eaglesham, Rudolf Hess parachuted supposedly into the same field. We just find that incredible. And I think it's arithmetically and mathematically very improbable that that would actually happen. Then, when I go on to tell you, Tony, that there are certain two eyewitness accounts that state that Rudolf Hess was actually helped out of the plane, the crashed plane, by two serving members of the Signals Regiment, one of which was called McBride, I think it puts significant doubt onto the parachute story. And there was a chap who used to live on the Isle of Rothsay, I think he's dead now, who again wrote in to say that he had been one of those Royal Signal Regiment detachment that had heard the plane crash, rushed to it, and helped Hess out of it. So the story really is, why did the British see fit, if indeed that was the case, to manipulate the truth to a parachute exit rather than a crashed landing? That's a really interesting question. We think it's possibly because a parachute landing is a more random act. It's not so self-determined, if you like, than a crashed landing. But I think on balance, the evidence is probably towards a crash landing rather than a parachute jump.
You mentioned it briefly, this idea of a doppelganger, the idea of doubles for Hess. As people may know, he was arrested at the time at the end of the Second World War. He was at the Nuremberg trials. I imagine looking rather askance at some of his other Nazi colleagues who he hadn't seen for probably 4 years or so. But the idea was that he's going to have a life imprisonment. He was put into Spandau Jail, which was actually in, I think it was in the east part of Berlin, so looked after by...
West part.
Was it in the west? Okay. But he was kept there for many years. Just before reunification of Germany, he was still alive. And yet, at that point, he conveniently died. Now, what do you make of this idea of doubles, and what about the so-called suicide?
I think Hugh Thomas, who was the author, meant well when he wrote his book. But he wrote his book in the days before DNA testing. He was a military doctor, and he claimed to have seen Hess's torso when Hess was undergoing a minor operation. And there was no bullet wound. And Rudolf Hess, it's recorded, was shot through the lung in Romania in the First World War when he was a serving infantry officer. But apparently it was a small bore rifle that shot him. And there's a big debate as to the lasting impact of scar tissue from small bore rifle bullets. And Hugh Thomas made the case that it wasn't the same man. But we met Rudolf Hess's grandson in Munich in 2015. And I don't know if your listeners are aware, but Rudolf Hess was buried in the family plot in Bavaria in 1988 when he was when he died. But he had to be reinterred or dug up and exhumed because the neo-Nazis kept rallying around his grave. So he was dug up in, I think, 2010. And at the same time, DNA evidence was taken to kill the doppelganger story and matched with Hess family members. And we suspect it was the grandson that we'd met that the DNA match was taken with. And they matched, not surprisingly. And the Hess in Spandau was definitely the Hess that landed in Scotland and was the Hess that had been Hitler's secretary for all those years. So I just saw the doppelganger as another handful of dust being thrown up into the air to obfuscate the real truth of the matter. no real surprise there, I suspect, Tony. It's what you've just said.
Yeah. So was it a suicide? Was it a natural death? What do you think really happened? Because it is all very convenient for the end of the East German West German divide.
It was very convenient. I don't think we will ever know that. There is evidence to support murder. There is evidence to support suicide. Very morbidly, Hess supposedly hung himself, in which case you wouldn't expect horizontal bruising across the back of the neck. You'd expect a triangulation where the noose tightened. But the Hess neck was horizontally bruised, which some people will say is evidence of throttling rather than hanging. The British conducted a post-mortem by a chap called Cameron, who was the British pathologist at that time, and he said it was death by hanging. And then the Hess family were given the body, and they conducted their own post-mortem by a Munich-based pathologist called Spann, and he decided that it was more likely to be death by throttling. So I'm afraid, Tony, you paid your money and takes your choice. I think there's evidence both ways there.
What about the Brits? So he was obviously planning to meet the British when he came to the UK. Is there any evidence that was actually some sort of genuine back channel, or was this just an excuse, do you think, to get Hess out of Germany? I notice, of course, that someone I research all the time, well, not all, quite all the time, but a lot, is this guy Martin Bormann, who controlled access to Hitler in the last years of the war. He did very well out of Hess's disappearance. So was there ever really any hope of some kind of back channel going on with Rudolf Hess coming to the UK?
Yeah, I think for sure there was. So the sequence of events is reasonably well documented now. So 31st of August 1940, Rudolf Hess goes for a walk in the Grunwald just outside Munich with his university professor, a chap called Haushofer, and says, is there anything we can do to make peace or to organise or talk about a peace with Britain? And Haushofer's son, who is very heavily connected with the British aristocracy, writes a letter dated the 23rd of September 40 to the Duke of Hamilton. The Duke of Hamilton was a very close friend of Albert Haushofer's, and that was really the start of the affair, because the letter went via Madrid, Lisbon, I beg your pardon, not Madrid, it went via Lisbon, and it was intercepted by the British postal censor. And we know that it was then diverted to MI5, MI6 and SOE. And that was then countered, we believe, by various other countermeasures, not least of which a trip to Geneva by an art historian called Tancred Berenius in January 41. And that was where the communication channels were maintained and continued. And that is all pretty well documented, Tony. There's lots of archives I could point you to with that documentation. Thereafter, when the pace of change, when the pace quickens, there is less documentation. But that doesn't mean to say that things weren't happening. And just recently, our latest work, we've been delighted to be given access to the Royal Archives. So we've actually seen the King's diaries for the time in question. And they too raised some very significant questions about where people were on the night. And that's really where our work has got to, and that's what we're studying at the present time.
So, okay, let's cut to the chase. Who was waiting for him up in Scotland?
Well, I don't know that, but I do know that there were members of the royal family in the area that night. But I can't tell you, and I won't say, that they were waiting for Hess.
No, okay, but they were in the vicinity. Fascinating, yeah.
Certainly in the vicinity.
I mean, it surely seems to me, you know, just to take a step back a minute, John, surely this could, sort of thing could have been arranged through diplomatic links over in Switzerland, etc., through the, because, you know, the UK and the United States had their representatives over in Switzerland, so did the Germans. It seems a lot like the sensible way, if they wanted to have some sort of secret exchange, a diplomatic exchange, much easier than sending the Deputy Führer over in an ME-110 that might crash.
Brilliant. Very spot on. I couldn't agree more. But the point being, Rudolf, time was running out. As you've said already, Barbarossa was only 6 weeks away. But when Barbarossa was first planned, it was due for May the 15th. It was delayed by 6 weeks because of the German excursion into the Balkans. So it was originally going to be May the 15th. So Rudolf Hess was under massive time pressure to do this deal if there was a deal to be done. And that's why, well, that's, first of all, Tony, that's why he flew to Scotland. If he wanted to make peace to with Winston Churchill, you wouldn't fly to Scotland, would you? You'd fly to Hendon or you'd fly to Norfolk or whatever.
Yeah.
So why Scotland?
Well, why did he have to fly anywhere at all? I mean, it's interesting what you're talking about, the delay to Barbarossa being caused by the, you know, in Yugoslavia and the Balkans, because there was a bit of a distraction there. I remember reading in A Man Called Intrepid that the Bletchley Park people had been reading all the codes from the Germans because they kept putting the same phrases in each and it made it much easier to decrypt what they were doing. And that there's, as a result of all of that, they knew Barbarossa was being planned. So they knew that it was important to try and aid a distraction. So there were a lot of German representatives in Yugoslavia deliberately killed in order to delay the beginning of the invasion of the Soviet Union. And many would argue that it was that delay, those 6 weeks or so delay in the invasion of the Soviet Union in 1941, that actually lost Germany the war. So obviously this was all quite, you know, it was all a bit on a knife edge. Martin, do you want to just chip in here? Because the, you know, Stalingrad, getting bogged down in the Russian winter was a big disaster for Hitler, wasn't it?
Well, that's right. And of course, having lost 6 weeks, you know, that's clearly going to have an impact on whether they were going to be successful or not. I think what crosses my mind about this is, what we're talking about here is links between the British establishment and the Nazis, which probably went back to before the war. And of course, what your research, Tony, about what happened with Martin Bormann, and, you know, the people don't realise that there was a great deal of under-the-table dealing going on, both before, during and after the war.
Well, let's not forget King Edward VIII, who actually was a Nazi. He decided that he was going to throw his... in fact, when you were talking about Lisbon, John, he's now known to have, in Lisbon, sent messages to the Nazis, actually encouraging them to bomb London in order to try and bring the British to negotiate with Hitler. Of course, that was one of the things that began the British bombing of German cities by Bomber Command, etc. So these things are still important. So you mentioned some of your most recent research. It just seems as if, for some reason, John, this story doesn't go away, does it?
No, not yet. Not yet, because I think two things. You've asked why did Hess have to fly. He had to fly because he'd basically run out of time and there had to be a physical manifestation to back up any peace deal. So if they'd run out of time. So there was no point in having a negotiation somewhere in Geneva, because without an act such as the Hess flight, it wouldn't have the credibility that it was actually going to hold water. So I think that's why Hess chose to fly. And the second thing is, I don't believe that the peace deal was between the German and the British governments. I think this is where the constitutional aspect of the affair comes into play. because the British Constitution is a funny old thing, and there's a very stark divide between the power of the monarchy and the power of the British government. And I think Hess thoroughly understood that difference. And I'm not convinced he was at all trying to attract the interest of the government, but I'm very interested in the notion that he was trying to attract the monarchy to act and exercise their power of prerogative. And if you think that sounds all very archaic and old-fashioned, don't forget that's exactly what Boris Johnson was trying to do when he got the Queen, or tried to get the Queen, to prorogue Parliament so he could get through his wretched Brexit bill. So that was 2019. And proroguement is not a device to be used recklessly, because unless the monarch could take the country with him, he would be made to look rather stupid rather quick. So it was always going to be a huge decision as to whether or not the monarch could be persuaded to exercise a prerogative. And don't forget, alongside that, dukes such as Hamilton automatically have access to the monarch at all times. That's an ancient right that they hold to this day. And until 1948, they could only be tried by their own peers. So whether or not that was a reaction to the Hess flight, I've yet to discover. But that's the British Constitution for you. So I don't see the Hess flight as government to government. I see the Hess flight as government to non-governmental body, but non-governmental body with the power to achieve what Hess wanted to achieve.
Well, it's like almost like aristocrat to aristocrat. Let's let these merchant politician classes carry on, but we're really in charge. We're the old feudal class. So your latest, I want to say something I think about Bormann, because my view of this is that there was an intelligence operation against the Nazi Party that was being run by MI6 during World War II, and particularly M Section, which is this particular part of MI6 which was controlled very directly by the King, George VI. And what we see, if you look at the timeline, is one by one, many of Hitler's closest confidants being spun out of the system. So he was left really towards the end of the war, I mean, especially after the removal of Hess, as Martin Bormann was really his only friend. He was certainly someone who'd known him for a long time. Reinhard Heydrich, who was Hitler's chosen successor, was also murdered. I think it was over in Czechoslovakia. These various people that Hitler was very close to as personal individuals, trusted friends, were one by one being removed. So I wonder whether there wasn't a little bit of British intelligence that sort of fed this idea that there was some sort of hope for peace, and that got into Hess's head that this was going to be a way of avoiding a calamity with the war continuing between Britain and Germany, and where for many people their real enemy was Bolshevism and the Soviet Union. John?
I wouldn't disagree with that notion at all. Where we've got to, Tony, is for some little while now, we know that was going on, but the difficulty is whether or not it was an outright coup attempt by the upper classes to get rid of Churchill, the warmonger, install somebody like Sam Hoare, who would then make a negotiated settlement and end the fighting with nominally a country to whom the British royal family were related to. Or was that the illusion that was being given in the hope that sufficient time would be bought so that the German attempt at Barbarossa would take place, and thus relieving the pressure on Britain that way? So it's really, was it a coup or a lure? And some weeks we're in the coup camp, other weeks we're in the lure camp. At the moment, I have to say, I think we're marginally in the coup attempt, in that we believe that there was going to be an attempt to remove Churchill and replace him with somebody more to the aristocracy's liking.
Yes, well, the intelligence services are very good at feeding people what they want to hear in order to convince them one way or another. Yes. Anyway, John, can you just give us, because there are two sort of different aspects to this in a way. It's a sort of technical side of the flight, the various equipment used, what actually happened. And then there's also the sort of politics of it. So I wonder if you could just share us your latest titles of your latest books about those two aspects.
Probably the most comprehensive book that we've done came out in 2023, and that was Conspiracy, Calamity and Cover-Up, which I think is exactly what the Hess affair was. And then in 2024, we did a very technical book about German radar systems, both of which have gone down surprisingly well. And now we're currently working on the political aspects again to try and nail the answer to the coup versus lure question. And hopefully there'll be a book out this year. So that's something we're looking forward to.
Yeah, well, me too. Okay, so maybe we'll be speaking to you again, John. Whereabouts can people find and follow you, whether it's online or get hold of your books?
Amazon, they're all on Amazon, and we maintain a Facebook page, but not very well.
Okay, John Harris, author of several books, Rudolf Hess, Conspiracy, Calamity and Cover-Up, and also the one you mentioned there, A New Technical Analysis of the Hess Flight, May 1941, with Richard Wilborn, both That's of right. them with Richard Wilborn. Thanks very much for joining us.
Pleasure.
Thanks,
always,
John.
All the best. Bye-bye.
Anyway, Martin, I still find this fascinating. He's still uncovering bits and pieces, and he's now this idea of was it a coup or was he lured? Was there really going to be a coup or was this just... What do you make of it?
Well, obviously, at this distance in time, it's difficult to know exactly. I mean, obviously, John has done a lot of research on it. What I think... the political significance of this is today is that at the end of the war, the Nazi intelligence structure was basically incorporated into NATO as it was being created. So Reinhard Gehlen, who used to head the Gestapo, ends up running the West German intelligence services. Now, of course, the current Russian intelligence services are very well aware of this history. They know exactly that the Nazis, the Nazis in East Germany and the rest of, the Soviet sphere of influence, they were pretty comprehensively crushed. But of course, the Ukrainian Nazis, a lot of them came over to the West. They went to Canada, and they were already being. Being encouraged to, they were rebelling against the Soviet occupation of the Ukraine.
Well, look, NATO feature big in this thing we were talking about earlier, the Dialogue Society, without a U and E on the end of it, of Peter Thiel's. So maybe they're ex-Nazi intelligence people or people, well, obviously they're not alive still, but their followers and people who think like the Nazis in that too.
Yes. And I think that if you look at NATO intelligence operations, things like Gladio, the bombing of Bologna railway station, the kidnap of Aldo Moro, the Prime Minister of Italy, NATO has always been a criminal organisation with Nazi influence. It's always been like that. And of course, the Russian General Staff and intelligence services are very well aware of all these things.
So in the middle of all this, of course, is this still this conflict with the what's now Moscow, Russia and Putin. And so Scott Ritter has been talking about that this week.
Ask about the compromises Russia made on the belief the United States would put ballistic missiles on the table to deal with the serious strategic implications of pulling out of the ABM treaty. And the Russians will all come back and say we were lied to. Because America lies to Russia. We cannot be trusted at all. Zero. Hmm. There is no future in believing there's going to be effective diplomatic interaction with the United States. And so long as the Russian government continues to behave as if there is some potential, and I know why they do it for diplomatic purposes, but maybe it's time to call a spade a spade. Because all you're doing is empowering the people in the United States who continue to tell the president, we own the Russians. we'll just send Steve Witkoff. They'll sit down and talk to the Russian president, and we own them. We'll continue this. Well, they don't own anything, but it creates a perception that shapes policy and has implications. And one of those implications is, instead of telling the Ukrainians to stand down, we continue to create the impression on Ukraine that if they just continue their long-range sanctions, a little bit more pain to Russia, then it can happen. And how does Russia respond? Inviting Steve Witkoff, which now has allowed the MI6 guys who control the Financial Times to put out the ridiculous story about Xi Jinping telling Donald Trump that Vladimir Putin's lost the war. They will continue to put stupid stories out there. And, you know, here's, this is the reality. The United States is agreement incapable. Russia will not have any agreement from the United States. How does Russia deal with that? Here's my solution. Rick, you guys just had like 30-degree weather in Russia. I heard Moscow hot. But a week prior to that, you had rain and you had to wear a sweater.
Yeah, and there was still some snow on the ground.
Yeah. Do you negotiate with the weather?
No.
Do you sit down and say, hey, weather, tomorrow I want to play golf. I'll tell you what, I'll give you this and that and the other thing for a sunny day. Can you negotiate with the weather? And the answer is no. The weather does what the weather does. All you can do is be prepared. So when it rains, you put on a raincoat. When it snows, you put on fur, shovel snow. Right now, Russia, to deal with the United States, you have to view the United States not as a negotiating partner, but as the kind of unpredictable actor as the weather. And the weather could be destructive. The weather could be beneficial. You just don't know which way the wind blows. You don't need to be a weatherman to know which way the wind blows. Bob Dylan.
Yeah, that is Bob Dylan. I've just been reading this week. I can't remember the name of the guy. He's a commentator in Russia, and they're saying, well, we're probably going to be at war with the West for the next 20 years or so, and that's got implications for all sorts of decisions we might take. And one of the things is suggesting all of our AI data centers will have to be underground. Yeah, everything's got to be, you know, when we build AI data centers in.
What about our nuclear power stations? Have they got to be underground?
Well, I mean, the Soviet era nuclear power stations are designed, you know, they've got huge concrete carapaces on them. They're designed to be, you know, you can't just blow them up easily. And I think that, you know, in a different kind of world,
well, of course you
could have all this infrastructure.
Listen, nowadays,
above
the weapons
above
available
ground.
Nowadays will take out a nuclear power station without hardly any trouble at all.
Well, I mean, the weapons that the Russians have got with their hypersonic missiles, they will take out bunkers. So even if we were to put our data centers underground, they would be able to blow them up. But we haven't got anything like that. So if the Russians put their data centers underground, we won't be able to blow them up.
Well, what you said last week on this program, we had a clip of Scott talking about Europe being like a rabid dog. He's saying basically you're going to have to shoot them because they've decided that they're going to have a war with Russia. Even if they lose, they don't care.
Well, I mean, it is quite mad what's going on. I mean, there is no way. I mean, even if you look at The Guardian, they keep going, oh, Putin's about to fall, Ukraine is winning.
Yeah, but it seems to be a serial problem with the Western leadership is they're quite happy to have, for example, a war with Iran that they lose. I mean, this goes back for many, many years. They lose almost every war, don't they? They just lose wars.
Yes,
and
I
they
know,
still
but I mean,
they want to keep starting new ones, yes, and this time with a nuclear power.
Yes, well, I mean, the thing is that the military-industrial complex hasn't lost at all. They've made a fortune out of it. Mm. You know,
isn't it sort of
Donald Trump's sons are investing in drone
production. It's Netanyahu syndrome, is that these people are actually deranged criminals, and the only way that they can keep the walls from the door is to say, oh, we need more wars, otherwise they're probably going to go to prison.
Well, that's right, and of course they're not necessarily rational. Crazy people do crazy things, yeah?
Especially Nazis on acid.
Well,
that's
right. So you can't presume, Michael Hudson points this out, you can't presume that people are pursuing rational self-interest. It may be that they are delusionary, yeah? They're delusionary and they've got access to all this weaponry. Very, very dangerous.
Let's have a listen to, we're going to hear Scott Ritter, a little bit more from Scott Ritter in a minute, but we've had this funny little guy, Zelensky, who thinks he's president, even though he's not elected. And in fact, he was elected to keep peace. And even though he started a war, he's been involved in that starting of the war, he's been going on and on and on without actually being re-elected as the so-called president of Ukraine. But he had this to say, I think it was in Versailles, in Paris today, at the G7 conference.
Russian ballistic missiles remain a problem, and we need an answer to that problem. So today, Ukraine
and Germany are taking very important, I think, important joint step. We have some technologies, Germany has some technologies, and today our defense ministers signed already an agreement to bring these capabilities together. In Ukraine, we have a company that is capable of producing ballistic missiles. Firepoint is moving toward this. And you have the capable companies as well. We have discussed this many, many times at the leaders level. There will be meeting at the NSA level. And we have already had meetings at the CEL level. So let us do this for our common defense as quickly as possible. And we invite all countries to contribute to these common efforts as much as possible. Our anti-ballistic coalition, all the countries that are part of it, must demonstrate full capability and deliver real results, better this year. By this winter, we should already see concrete outcomes from our joint work on anti-ballistic defense. This is something we all need, not only Ukraine, and it is a long-term effort. Please support it at every level and in every possible way. I thank all of you who support our work through the Pearl Program. Thanks, Mark, for your personal involvement. Thank you very much. Right now, it is making a real difference alongside all of our bilateral cooperation. Sometimes these deliveries make the difference literally day by day. When we know that Russia is preparing a massive strike against Ukraine and we are able to receive Patriot missiles the day before that attack, it helps save lives. So timing matters. And I know that some countries have already prepared decisions on new contributions on Pearl, and I'm very grateful for this. Please, let us implement these decisions as quickly as possible. And we have heard that some countries would like to announce their contributions to Pearl at the summit in Ankara this year, but that is still several weeks away. Let us make these important decisions here at this meeting so that we can deliver the weapons needed for protection. Russia attacks Ukraine every day. So please do not postpone, even by a single day, what can be done through Pearl today.
So he seems to me like a sort of the guy that won't stop saying all this stuff. And many of the European leaders, I wonder if at some point they don't really care that much about Zelensky. They might just jettison him. But it seems their spokesperson. He's demanding this. He's demanding that. And he's the perfect guy to keep this war going against Russia, even though he's not really president of Ukraine anymore. And he never did what he was said he would do when he was elected in the first place.
Well, that's right. I mean, he's there begging for further support to keep the killing going.
He's getting it, isn't he?
Well, this is the trouble.
I mean, Ukraine has just sent Moscow's oil refinery up in flames with the largest drone attack on the city for 2 years. Zelensky's called the strike a fully justified response to Russian strikes on our cities and communities. Now, the Russians know full well this is a massive refinery, which was a different one. Twice they've hit refineries this week, sending black clouds of smoke into the air and disrupting commercial flights. The Russian air defences shot down at least nearly 200 drones headed for the city, according to the Moscow mayor, part of a major long-range attack across parts of Russia, with air defences intercepting 555 drones overall, according to Russian Ministry of Defence. Now, the Russians know exactly where these drones are coming from. They know exactly who's paying for them. They know exactly who's building the warheads for them. And they know it's Europe, and particularly Britain.
That's right. And, of course, they've given a list of all the places which are making these drones, some in Britain, some in other European countries. So if you carry on doing this, we're going to blow those factories up. We're not saying when, but if we do, these will be the factories that will blow up. Now, we're getting very, very close to a full-on shooting war. The Russians are prepared for a full-on war with NATO. They know that they can't just fight the Ukraine. They're not just fighting the Ukraine. Now, what should be happening in Europe is everybody should be getting a bit of common sense.
It's absolutely ludicrous
to imagine that you're going to defeat the Russians.
Zelensky's best friend there is Mark, isn't it? Mark Rutter, the NATO guy. He's not actually representing any country.
No,
this is just NATO, who we were hearing about earlier on as part of Peter Thiel's little death cult.
Yes, but the NATO itself is in disarray because the US basically wants the Europeans, West Europeans, the British, to carry on fighting with the Ukrainians, with the Russians, and because they don't want to spend any more money on it. Now, this phase of the world war, we now get to a situation where people are going to be thrown under the bus. I mean, obviously, what's going to happen in Western Europe is we're going to have a very, very severe economic crisis, far worse than anybody else's.
What, caused by Hormuz or what?
Well, caused by that, and of course, all the money.
Well, we can talk about that in a minute.
We can talk about that in a minute. But it seems
to me the main thing is this business with Russia. The West has taken on, you know, I was saying about the Eye of Sauron earlier, the West has taken on more than it can chew, bitten off more than it can chew, with having both the Gaza, Iran, Israel war at the same time, supporting that as supporting the Russian war, and it's just decided, well, let's just put Gaza on hold for a bit. Let's just nobble the Russians.
Well, I mean, the fact is that the war has its own logic and it's got its own dynamic. But look at Andy Burnham. If he becomes Prime Minister, he's going to come under enormous pressure from the establishment in this country and from, you know, the United States. And we've got to spend loads more. We've got to rearm, Tony. We've got loads of things we need to spend money on, apprenticeships and all the things he was talking about.
Have you
earlier,
seen about the Russian tanker in the channel that was boarded this week? Yeah. That seems to me is just as the previous defence secretary resigned last week. The new guy who's just come in is saying, "Yeah, okay, well, let's just board." But it turns out, as Craig Murray said in his article, that the actual registration of this ship had only just been changed due to threats to the Liberians as it was actually sailing along. And
that's
once
right.
this had happened, so the whole thing was a setup for the press, really. And
that's
also
right.
the other thing, which is extraordinary about the Marines boarding the ship, was that you had the cameraman actually in front of the soldiers as they're coming in. So the whole thing was a setup. So
that's
not
right.
only were the Russians set up in that they changed the registration of the ship, forced that to be changed as it's sailing towards the English Channel, but then they also sent cameramen in to pretend that these guys were actually charging through the ship. It's almost as if this whole thing is just done as a legend or a mythos or a fake for the telly.
Yes, a bit like the Skripal poisoning in Salisbury. People don't realise that our intelligence services basically pull these stunts all the time. And the
but it's not real war, is it?
No,
surely it's some sort of illusion that they're
creating. No, what it's for, Tony, is to get the British public into the mood for fighting with the Russians. Mm. Yeah? Now, in actual fact, nobody in this country has got any interest whatsoever in having a war with the Russians. We really don't. And you can imagine people in Portugal even less so.
I mean, surely even the military don't want to.
Well, the mainstream military, they see this as a gravy train, which is why you get all these ex-military guys on the TV saying we need to spend more money on defence. And
this is an arms industry gravy train, really.
That's
isn't
right.
It?
And of course, when they retire, these generals end up on the boards
with the revolving doors of
BAE systems and all the rest of it. So it's their retirement plan. Now, from a practical point of view, the Western Europe cannot afford to build a massive military. Secondly, from a military point of view, it'll take at least 10 or 20 years, and the war's on now this minute, so building a factory to build tanks in 5 years' time is no use to you whatsoever.
Not win a war
from a military
tanks.
Point of
this
view.
Is
well,
technology.
I know, but whatever you're making, drones
whether,
or whatever.
Whether that technology is hypersonic missiles or satellite TV. Who knows? But anyway, look.
We haven't got any hypersonic missiles. This is a game changer. Russia, the West simply hasn't got any.
Okay, so whatever we do in engaging with war with Russia is going to be a disaster. Scott Ritter is saying the only way to do this is to talk. They won't talk. They refuse to talk because they've just made it. What he's saying in this also this week is that the Russians have actually already. What do you think if that's true? The Russians have already decided that they will be attacking the West now. It's just a question of when.
No, I think what the Russians have said and made it absolutely clear is we do not want to fight with you, but if you carry on provoking us, we will. You can't use places like Latvia as a base for attacking us. We're going to fire back. If ultimately, of course, the British are regarded as very much the protagonists here. The Ukrainian.
Why?
Because we run the Ukrainian SBU. Zelensky is a British agent, and even if we remove Zelensky and put Zaluzhny in, who is based at British, he's basically a Ukrainian ambassador to Britain. The British are regarded by the, because the Americans are not blow hot and cold about whether they want to fight the Russians. The British are absolutely determined that we're going to fight the Russians. Absolute madness. I mean, we've got, you know, I mean,
this, I wonder this, what Tampon Charlie's got to say
well,
about
it. Well, we know what he's got to say about it. We've got to fight Putin. He's been out there. He went to the Congress in the United States and said, we've got to carry on fighting Putin.
And he also
Putin.
Said that That's Putin said. Is Hitler.
Well, yes.
A tennis course, match.
Well, you can understand that many people in Russia, which lost 27 million casualties in World War II, are not impressed with the King of England, whose relatives look as if they were in the pocket of Hitler,
Russians.
saying it's that not, he's Hitler.
It's not just what Russians, it's the relatives of people who died in this country fighting Hitler.
That's right, but I mean, what's actually been going on with NATO and all the rest of it has been an insult to Britain's war dead in two world wars all along. Yeah, all this false flag terrorism and all the rest of it. Our intelligence services are truly wicked. But of course, people think of things like James Bond and all the rest of it, and they just presume that they mean well. The answer is they don't mean well. They never meant well, and they're going to drag us all down to disaster.
This is why I actually really love what David Dimbleby has been doing here, is in pulling apart the establishment and showing just how little actual democracy there is left.
During the Biden administration, we said if Russia used a nuclear weapon against Ukraine, we would respond non-nuclear with long-range standoff weapons, which we no longer have, by the way. So, you know, we're not going to respond with nuclear weapons. If Russia launches a conventional attack against Europe, we'd have to respond conventionally, and we lack it right now. And there's no way Europe's going to commit suicide. What is Europe going to do? Could you imagine the decision-making, discussion in Paris? Oh, Mr. President, I can't use a French accent, so I won't try. But France wins. But something you don't hear every day. Cheers. But they launch a drone attack against Germany. Now the French meet. They say, what weapons do they use? A bunch of Shahids, a couple of Reshniks. What's our response? What are you going to, launch a couple nukes from a submarine? Mr. President, the moment the submarine launches, the Russians are going to hit us with 2% of their nuclear arsenal, and all of France will disappear. Because that's the discussion that will be had in London, in Paris, anywhere. The second we respond with something that looks like a nuclear weapon, the Russians have said we won't be the first to launch, but we're not going to be the first to receive. Meaning that if the Russians detect a launch, the Russians will respond with everything they have. So now put yourself in a French decision maker. You're going to make that call? Well, especially if somebody in your intelligence says, well, this German sort of asked for it, boss. You know, we've been warning you about the consequences of building weapons for the Ukrainians and giving it to the Ukrainians and giving intelligence that the Russians aren't going to sit there and take that all day. So Russia has responded with conventional weapons. We have no ability to respond conventionally. What do we do, Mr. President? You want to commit suicide? You want to fire a nuke against Russia and Russia will kill everybody here and in all of Europe? Do you want that, Mr. President? And the answer is no. Europe will do nothing and the Russians know they will do nothing. Want to know why the Russians know they will do nothing? Because Russian intelligence is pretty damn good. And if you don't think the Russians have literally recruited people on the inside of the decision-making cycles in a completely broken up France. France is the easiest place to recruit a politician nowadays because they have political dissension everywhere. England's the second easiest place to recruit. Germany, Russia owns Germany in terms of inside decision. Russia has intelligence operatives throughout Europe, and they know exactly what Europe's thinking. And so I don't think the Russians, I think Vladimir Putin is a very well-informed national leader who has been very pragmatic for a reason. There's a reason why he hasn't been seeking to expand this conflict, because he's been confident in the outcome. But now Europe has crossed red lines. Europe has empowered Ukraine to bring real harm to Russia. So Russia is going to take Ukraine off the playing field and punish Europe, because Russia can't sit back and allow Europe to believe that they can build up a military capable of fighting Russia by 2029, 2030. I think the decision's already been made.
Well, that's pretty accurate, I think. What strikes me about all of this is the total unreality of it. People have been talked into a sort of knee-jerk hostility to Russia, and it depresses me, because
there's very good reasons to be hostile against the Russians. A UNESCO listed cathedral in Kiev this week was set alight during a Russian attack. Restoring the Kiev cathedral hit by the Russians this week could take 2 years, says the cathedral director.
All right, and at the same time there's been attacks on Moscow by the Ukrainians. And of course, we've got an election.
The Russians have said, by the way, that this was a Patriot defense missile that hit the cathedral.
Well, that's right. So, in other words, they're attacking infrastructure. There's no reason for them to attack the cathedral, but the Patriots go up and try and blow down and knock down the incoming missiles. And
we're not getting the Russian side of the story at all, are we?
No, we're not. I mean, most people in this country are still blissfully unaware of the massacre at Starobelsk 2 weeks ago. Everybody in Russia has been looking at the pictures of these poor teenage girls, you know, and they're grinding their teeth with fury and demanding that something's done about it. But people in Britain, and I include probably Andy Burnham in this, does he know that the Ukrainians bombed a university dormitory and killed 21 teenage girls? Does he know? I bet you he doesn't. This is the problem. He wants to be the prime minister. He doesn't know basic facts about the world, the way the world is. We've been completely cut off. You know, since RT's been banned, we've been cut off from knowing what the Russians do or say. We just get MI6 telling us what the Russians think. And that's very dangerous, because ordinary people are being basically led up the garden path here. And of course, if we do finally have missiles hitting Filton, never mind Palestine action activists, proper Russian hypersonic missiles landing on Elbit systems or the equivalent up in Filton, they won't go for maximum casualties. They'll probably do it in the middle of the night, but the factories will be eliminated. And then suddenly we'll say, well, what are we going to do? We can't do anything. We can't fire back, because we've got nothing to fire back with. We need to make peace, because that's all there is to do.
So the Russian news tonight is talking about the United States intelligence has warned that Israel could sabotage a US-Iran peace deal. And also, whilst we're talking about the Russian situation, Ukraine's labs were never peaceful facilities, studied biological warfare agents. More information coming out about the Ukrainian bio labs.
That's right. Well, Tulsi Gabbard had a load of information that she gathered about this, and her office was raided and all that stuff was taken away. Now, most people don't realise, but the Russian general staff probably do realise, that COVID was a deliberately created bioweapon, deliberately released. The Iranians know that, because Salami, who was the head of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, who died in the 12-day war, he came straight out as soon as COVID broke out in Iran, said, we think this is a biological warfare attack. You've just killed our general Soleimani and various other people in a sneak attack in Baghdad when he was on his way to Saudi Arabia to talk peace, and the Americans had encouraged him to do that. And then suddenly all this COVID stuff comes out in Wuhan, but the strain of COVID in Iran wasn't the same as the Chinese strain. Slightly different. In other words, this both big enemies of the Western deep state, the Chinese and the Iranians, that's where the ground zero was for COVID. And of course, COVID was a biological warfare, because they captured all these places in the Ukraine. They were definitely messing around with COVID.
The Russians are another big headline in Russia. The people in Russia talking about this all the time as we try and hack through this ridiculous firewall that's been put up around Russian news, which both you and I used to be on regularly, Martin, is that the British are to send Ukraine 150,000 drones.
Yes, and who's going to pay for that? We're going to pay for that because the Ukrainians
apparently
have got no money.
It's a loan that when they win, they'll pay us back.
Oh, right. Now, what that means is, Andy Burnham, if he becomes prime minister, the deep state will say, OK, you can become prime minister, but you've got to go along with all of this. And what I fear is he will go along with all of this because I don't see anybody in the British establishment mainstream that actually is willing to stand up to this warmongering rhetoric. We really shouldn't be going to war with the Russians at all. Bad idea. And of course, it's the Americans that blew up the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, which is going to put everybody out of work in Europe. Not the Russians, the Americans. Now, who should we go to war with? The Russians or the Americans?
How about neither?
Yeah, maybe we should just mind our own business, eh?
Why is it that there is this drive for war then?
Well, because it's capitalism in crisis. Yeah, in a crisis, the way to resolve it is to capture markets and control, more colonies. And that's been what's been driving both First, Second and Third World Wars.
Okay, so we've been talking negatively for a long, long time. But so let's say something nice and positive now. This is our final main story, and that is the peace breaking out between the United States and Iran, much to the consternation of Benjamin Netanyahu and the Israelis, who just continued attacking Lebanon despite this peace deal between Iran and the United States. And apparently last night is the last straw, and Trump has made sure, and the Americans are making sure, that Lebanon is now included in this peace deal too. So the Israelis' attacks have been now postponed, and the Israelis have been very firmly told no more attacks on Lebanon. In fact, there were even rumours that Trump had said on a private call to Netanyahu, remember, we could bomb you too.
Well, I don't know whether he said that or not, but I'll just point out that because Israeli occupation forces are still in Lebanon and still fighting, and Hezbollah and the Israeli occupation forces were knocking the hell out of each other this afternoon, and the Iranian Revolutionary Guard have said, if they're not going to withdraw, then we're going to close the Straits of Hormuz. So the Straits of Hormuz has been closed this afternoon, as far as I know. So this peace deal, this is the 38th peace deal that Trump has claimed. He's claimed 38 times.
Well, hang on, because both sides are claiming it. They are both claiming it. Anyway, let's have a listen to what Donald Trump had to say this week, in fact, yesterday.
President, what are the expectations for Israel? Can this deal survive if Israel attacks Lebanon?
It can, and, I consider that the minor war, the Iran's a big one, but we have that a little pinprick out there that constantly rears its head, and that's Hezbollah. And, I was very responsible for Syria, and the man that's running Syria now is a person that I put there along with President Erdogan and some others. He's done an amazing job of pulling it together. He's not a Boy Scout, but he's done an amazing job of pulling it together. And he is very good with Hezbollah, does not like them. And I'll tell you what, Israel's fighting Hezbollah too long and too many people are being killed. And you don't have to knock down an apartment house every time you're looking for somebody, because there are a lot of people in those apartment houses, and they're not all Hezbollah, that I can tell you. And I suggested to Israel to let Syria take care of Hezbollah, because to be honest with you, I think they'd do a better job of doing it. And I didn't like Syria. I didn't like where 2 hours before we're signing the agreement, that was an attack in Lebanon, in Beirut. It wasn't like in the southern side, and it was in Beirut. I did not like that. I let them know that. I didn't like it, not at all. But I think that Syria, he's pulled that country together amazingly quickly. He's very capable, and he's been very good for me. He's protected everything that I've asked for. He's done. And if Israel can't do the job, without killing everyone else, he'll do the job. Syria will do the job.
Are you frustrated with Netanyahu, sir?
No. We had a great relationship. We're talking about some end details. I didn't like the did an attack based on a, you know, there's a very minor little thing with some drones that were released, and he ends up going over. I saw that attack. I saw where that bomb went. Did you see what happened? That was not, that was a vicious, that was too much. You know, you can do too much also. But we've had a very effective relationship. Without us, without the United States, there would be no Israel. Without me, there would be no Israel, because no other president was willing to do what I did. I've had a great relationship with Bibi, but now Bibi has to be more responsible with respect to Lebanon. Lebanon used to be a great country. It was a country where you had professors, doctors, lawyers. The great intellect was in Lebanon. Now it's just, it's terrible. I would say of all countries, they've been treated the worst. And they can't defend themselves. And they have Hezbollah, which is a problem for them. So, no, I'm not happy with the way Israel has handled themselves with Lebanon and with Hezbollah.
So he's got a good relationship with Benjamin Netanyahu, but he's actually rather cross with him for bombing Beirut, just for virtually nothing, which is making a mess of his peace agreement.
Well, that's right. And the question is, can Trump tell Bibi what to do?
Well, if Trump can't, maybe J.D. Vance can.
If I was in the cabinet of the Israeli government, I might not be attacking the only powerful ally that I have anywhere left in the entire world. Could torpedo the deal, because I think the president's expectation is that all of our friends, the Israelis, the Arabs in the region, we're going to work together and actually see this deal to completion. Now, I saw the Axios report, you know, that Netanyahu is fuming. That's not reflective of the conversations that I've had with him, but maybe he's saying something to somebody else that he's not saying to me. What I will say, and this does bother me, is that you've seen people within Bibi's cabinet who have come out and attacked the deal, and in some ways very personally attacked the President of the United States. And I guess my message to them would be twofold. Number one, Donald J. Trump is the only head of state in the entire world who is sympathetic to the nation of Israel at this moment in time. And he happens to be the head of state of the world superpower. If I was in the cabinet of the Israeli government, I might not be attacking the only powerful ally that I have anywhere left in the entire world. And the second message I would give to some of those cabinet members, Bibi, to his credit, has not gone down this path, but to some of these cabinet members in Israel who are attacking the President of the United States, the other thing that I would say is that over the last 3 months, two-thirds of the defensive weapons that have protected your homeland have been built by American hands and paid for by American tax dollars. The problem for Israel is not Donald J. Trump. And anybody in Israel who thinks their biggest problem is the President of the United States needs to wake up and smell the reality of the situation that country is in. Speak to Bibi or speak to somebody in the Israeli government, just as we speak to the Gulf Coast Coalition, our regional partners, pretty much every day, at least at some high level of our government. Look, the president's been very clear. He does not withdraw from Israel. No one could withdraw from another country the right of self-defense. Israel has the right to defend itself. But fundamentally, the Israelis, just like everybody else, have to respect this peace process that is fundamentally good for them and good for the entire region. What the president has grown frustrated sometimes is that we seem to be right on the cusp of a major breakthrough in the agreement, and then all of a sudden there's a major explosion that goes off in a civilian population center in Beirut, and a lot of people who have nothing to do with Hezbollah lose their lives. That's not acceptable. That's the sort of thing that we've asked for closer coordination so that we ensure it doesn't happen. And our message to the Israelis, just as our message to everybody else, is fundamentally, we want this peace process to be good for you.
Well, that message is being ignored, Martin, isn't it? Because this afternoon, the Israelis have been launching more deadly strikes against Lebanon. The new round of direct talks between the US and Iran have been postponed after Vice President J.D. Vance delayed his planned trip to Switzerland. The White House has announced late yesterday that Vance would not be travelling under the talks and said logistics had not been simple or predictable. Anyway, that was yesterday, but today things seem to be calming down a little bit, if I dare say that. Netanyahu has reaffirmed that they will not be withdrawing from South Lebanon. The Lebanon-Israel ceasefire is now in place after 47 were killed, 93 wounded last night. Three have been killed in Lebanon attacks as the Israel issues a new occupation map. The Americans are definitely starting to really criticise the Israelis. Do you think they really mean it, opposed to this memorandum of understanding?
Well, I think what's happening is because the Iranians have basically won the Gulf War, they're now, the Israelis and the Americans are now rowing about who's going to, you know, what's going to happen next. But of course, it's always, Bibi may disappear, you know, but somebody else will be elected in Israel, be just as extreme as Bibi and more, because that's the mentality of the Israelis.
Vance has been criticising those in Israel who have been opposed to this memorandum of understanding, the 14 points between the US and Iran. And Netanyahu is now left with sort of twiddling his thumbs, really, into trying to influence the US-Iran deal through US media figures, so influencers in America that they've been paying for years. They're trying to influence US policy through them because they've run out of rope with Vance and Trump.
Yes, but if you look at the political system in the US, in Congress and in the Senate, the pro-Israeli voices are dominant. The public opinion in the US is overwhelmingly moving against Israel. But of course, to get elected in the US, you don't just have to get the votes of people, you also need loads of money. And so Massey, who was a Republican critic of Israel, he's just been removed from the political process by massive spending by pro-Israeli donors to his opponent in the primary in Kentucky. Now, in other words, Trump is one of the things that's got to happen if this deal goes through is that the Congress has got to vote to lift sanctions on Iran, because it isn't up to the
president. Hang on a second, because CENTCOM today has announced that they're ending the US blockade of Iran. So yes, this is already beginning, isn't
that
it?
That began.
And obviously, this is
creating
panic in Tel Aviv.
That's right. So, in other words, everything was starting to move in the right direction. And of course, it's creating panic in Tel Aviv, but they're always in a position to wreck everything. Of course they are. Yeah, they can just decide we're not going to take...
Well, are they? I mean, are they really going to... now this decision has been reached. I mean, both Trump and Vance are sending... Or Vance more than Trump, though, is sending out very clear signals to the Israelis. We've had enough of you messing us around, especially if there has been a conversation, as has been rumoured, which the US appears to have leaked, the White House appears to have leaked, that they're actually threatening the Israelis. Look, don't mess up our peace deal. We can bomb you. Remember that.
Well, I mean, I think you read what the problem is, that they're not in a position to carry through on these threats. The Israelis really are dangerous, and
of course they
could.
US Navy could, couldn't it?
They could, but the point is that Trump is actually on the way out. Yeah, he's not going to be in power that much longer.
Or he could be assassinated by the Israelis.
Anything could happen, Tony.
Is it possible for Trump to be assassinated by the Israelis?
There could be another false flag attack, like the 9/11 attack. As Trump said, and the week after 9/11, I build these buildings, they don't collapse like that into their own footprint. Because it was the Israelis who blew them up.
What do you read into the resignation of Tulsi Gabbard? Because that's quite an interesting one.
It's not a resignation, she's forced out. Yeah.
Well, apparently she resigned. But you say, but what do you read? Why? Why?
Why? Because she's basically saying, she joined the administration with the possibility of trying to influence the deep state to not do stupid stuff. So they've just sidelined her and now they've got rid of her. That's the way politics works in the US. It's very, very difficult to change it. If you're somebody like John F. Kennedy, you can end up dead or you're not going to get elected in the first place. And it's all to do with money. Money. Of course it is.
Mm. Well, I certainly think the focus seems to have switched to helping the Ukrainians to provoke Russia in this kind of proxy war that's going on up there. Flotsam and jetsam, says Patrizia this week, her ode. Mere scallywags, or some may say, for the MOD to act this way. Piracy, state-sponsored score. A set-up, get-up. Staged for war. All aboard The Smeartos crawled with cameraman, no sense at all. Ahoy me hearty, a motley crew, stage left, stage right, with much ado. A dressing down, no even keel, not hot chase, devoid of truth, conceal. Another plan to blame and scape the Russians, who they seem to hate. A pile-on show of strength they hoped, instead of which on them the joke. Shiver me timbers, Smear's last chance, now in the offing, his final dance. Thanks very much, Patrizia. And we'll finish this week with a theme that comes up again and again. This is a occultic thing, which is called the satanic inversion, how they flip everything to rule you.
We are basically living in a world that's been spiritually hijacked, you know, and it's by design. It's not by accident. You have to understand that Satanism isn't just about demons, pentagrams, you know, goat heads and all of that stuff. It's about inversion. The deliberate flipping of everything sacred, everything natural, everything moral into its opposite. For example, where now love becomes lust. Now truth becomes manipulated and you don't know whether this is the truth anymore or what exactly is it, you know? The freedom that we have or we thought we have, it becomes control. And the people running this world, they've mastered this inversion. Inversion is the foundation of real satanic philosophy, not the cartoon version you were taught to mock. No, 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 not the devil with pitchfork. It has nothing to do with devil worship. It's about rebellion against the natural order. If something is pure, satanic inversion corrupts it. If something is holy, it's going to desecrate it. You know, it's a spiritual game of opposites where the laws of nature are reversed or replaced. And the deeper you look, the more you realize that this actually isn't just happening in secret. You know, it's actually happening everywhere in front of your face. You know, I mean, we're told that we live in a free society, but every year we get more surveillance, more censorship, more control. They tell us that we're making progress, but spiritually, mentally, emotionally, people are actually collapsing. You know, they'll tell you that, oh, love wins, but families are breaking. Children are confused. People use each other and call it liberation. Every truth itself has been inverted. Lying is rewarded, pretending is celebrated, reality is optional. Reality is optional. You have to understand that the goal of inversion is not just destruction, it's replacement. If you destroy family but don't replace it with something, society collapses. But if you destroy it and replace it with the state, you control the people. If you destroy faith but replace it with moral relativism, you erase responsibility. Nobody has morals anymore. Nobody actually knows what's actually right or wrong. You know, they say it's subjective. Right and wrong are subjective, not objective. If you destroy masculinity and femininity, childhood, truth, and then rebuild those concepts under your control, you own the blueprint of the future. That's what the inversion does. It doesn't remove the secret. It changes it or mutates it into something programmable.
Yeah, so who is that? That's the question. Sorry, I really ought to know, didn't I? How they flip everything to rule you, satanic inversion. So I'll put a link up to that on our show page, the actual original video, so you can figure that out. Sorry, it's really rather slack of me not to beforehand figure out who that is. I see there's just been a train crash in Bedford this evening, sadly. I don't quite know if there's casualties, etc. But of course, all eyes are going to be on Andy Burnham, aren't they? Who is this guy? He's almost, I mean, of course, Starmer would be an complete idiot to try and stand against him because he'll just be humiliated. But, you know, I think in a way, the mentality at the top in Westminster and Windsor Castle is the same as the mentality when it comes to Russia and Ukraine. They're basically just a bunch of losers. And they painted themselves into a corner and they're trying to drag us lot down with them. So we have to do something. Maybe Andy Burnham is part of that. We shall see. It's a war on God, but God's going to win. Time to sign off now. Thanks very much to Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. Also to John Harris, our guest. And of course to good old Roger Cook for doing that interview all those years ago and all the marvellous work that he did. Long may he be remembered and him inspire young journalists too. Also thanks to sound engineer Dave Bazanko. You can download this show as an MP3 from 11 p.m. to listen in the car or anywhere you like. Follow Tony Gosling Censored on Telegram. Do please share interviews and story tips on my Tony Gosling Censored Telegram group, as some very wonderful person did during the week with that Wired article about Peter Thiel's creepy little Fourth Reich group that he's trying to secretly get everyone together near Dublin in April. Brilliant bit of investigative journalism by then, and exposing the secret government, the parallel government, the Nazis on acid, getting on with their nasty work and their accelerationism. It's a brilliant piece of journalism from Wired. Also, you can send me stuff on WhatsApp if you want, or come to my Facebook page, Face Arse, as we call it often, and download this show and full-length interviews. Subscribe to my free weekly newsletter with all lots of stories to do with this programme, just backing up what we're saying. And, of course, don't believe a word of it, but there it is. You can donate or even set up a small monthly sub. Thanks if you already do. That's at the show page this week, oneword.org.uk. This show is repeated at 11 p.m. on Fridays and at 11 and 5 a.m. and p.m. all week on the stream, except 5 p.m. Monday to Thursday, when you can hear Richie Allen live. Yep, on the app and on that stream. We're streaming live now from Bristol, just about still, on the talkradio.org.uk stream, at djplugradio.co.uk in Nuneaton, Warwickshire, holylandradio.com, at 87.7 FM in West Sweden, Wisconsin, and live on the Bristol Politics Show app. If you can restream this show live or rebroadcast us, if you dare, let me know and I'll credit you here. Have a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for the Bristol Politics Show next Friday at 5. Do a good deed every day and don't let the synagogue of satanic banksters get you down.
Laudabilis numerum. gloriae Christe, tu patris sempitermus est filius,
tu ad libem ramus sus securus hominem, non voluis virginis utero,
tu de victum mortis aculeo, aperum isti credentibus regna celorum.
Tu ad dexteram Dei servus in gloria Patris.
Judex crederis esse venturus.
Te ergo quesumus tuis fabulis ut veni, quos precioso sangue
clean clothes, you don't need a weatherman to know it's